afraid of. Take what's there. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting November 24th. Much of the radical info for this week's show came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. This week's show features audio segments produced by the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and inspiration for the whole kit and caboodle came from the Slingshot organizer. Here we go.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History for November 24th starts out with New World Shenanigans, when on this date in 1656, New Hampton, Long Island, now New York, passes laws restricting native movements. After all, they did sell the land for some whiskey and colored beads. New rules against renting land to former inhabitants, not allowing wigwams to be set up without the town permission, and not allowing natives to travel through the area on the Sabbath. You know, honoring God on his holy day by restricting his creatures. Also November 24, 1898, International Anti-Anarchist Conference, prompted by the assassination of Empress of Austria, is convened by Italian government officials in Rome. 54 delegates representing 21 countries, including police chiefs from several European countries and major cities. The conference marks the development and strategic international surveillance of and exchange of information about anarchist activities. Yes, we are everywhere.
You've come to the wrong shop for anarchy, brother.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
They assemble?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose?
To quote government officials, the government is, quote, crawling with commies, unquote. Like the Hollywood Ten, a group who refused to testify on this date in 1947 before the U.S. House Committee on Un-American Activities about alleged communist involvement. The ten are blacklisted. Some are sent to prison. The chairman of the committee, Jay Parnell, wanting to show us all what it really means to be a good American, is convicted 4 years later for padding his payroll and pocketing the money. Also on November 24, 1963, the first televised assassination, Kennedy assassin Oswald is killed by mobbed-up Jack Ruby. I'm sure it was Ruby's patriotism that brought him to kill the former Marine. More great Americans, for on this date in 1969, Lieutenant William L. Calley is charged with the massacre of over 100 civilians in My Lai, Vietnam, in March of 1968. And is ordered to stand trial and is court-martialed, eventually found guilty, and does a short stint of house arrest. Another great American, future Secretary of State Colin Powell, then First Lieutenant, was in charge of the initial cover-up of the My Lai massacre. Lastly, for November 24, 1979, federal government for the first time admits that troops in Vietnam were exposed to the toxin Agent Orange. Ironically, last week in a buried news story, the U.S. government admits that Gulf War Syndrome really does exist, showing once again how disposable veterans are. And thanks for serving. This week in radical history for November 25th, 1500 in Spain, Columbus returns after his third voyage to the New World in chains, although it'd be a little too late.
This is your radio supporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, November 25th, in 1894, the U.S. military arrested 19 Hopi men for their continued resistance to the government's program of forced education, assimilation, and land seizure. About a month after being removed from their homes and families, the Hopi prisoners were sent to the military prison on Alcatraz Island for, quote-unquote, seditious conduct, and were held for almost a year. The story of the Alcatraz prisoners is just one episode in an ongoing struggle between the Hopi people and the U.S. government. During the late 1800s, there were many U.S. government attacks on the Hopi people's sovereignty and culture as an effort to Americanize them through imprisonment, intimidation, and punishment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
And we're trying to keep history alive by letting you know that on this date in 1904, Ba Jin, also known as Pa Chin, is born, a Chinese novelist who discovered anarchism with the reading of Peter Kropotkin and Emma Goldman, and he created a pseudonym, Ba, for Bakunin, and Jin for Kropotkin. This famous Chinese novelist, Ba Jin, was constantly harassed by the communists, and in 1949 he was forced by them to rewrite his stories, removing or replacing all anarchist references with communist ones. Throughout his life, he is constantly harassed, like in 1966 when he was again disgraced, branded as a great poisonous weed by the Communist Party, as his writings were eventually condemned as seditious. Also on November 25th of 1919, amid a strike for union recognition by 359,000 steelworkers, ultimately successful, approximately 250 anarchist, communist, and labor agitators were deported to Russia yesterday, marking the onset of the so-called Red Scare. George Bernard Shaw would say about this time, quote, "The United States is a country where truth is tarred and feathered, lynched, imprisoned, clubbed, and expatriated as undesirable." George Bernard Shaw. Two more items from November 25th, like in 1997, during a traditional town reenactment of the Thanksgiving myth in Plymouth, police attacked Native American demonstrators, beating and pepper spraying several and arresting 25. History is written by the victors, and we'll be damned if we're not going to keep it that way. Lastly, on this date in 2001, Katie Sierra, a 15-year-old 10th grader at Sensenville High School in Charleston, West Virginia, is suspended for anti-war sentiments and her desire to start a student anarchist club. She self-identifies as an anarcho-pacifist and was kicked out of the school for opposing the Afghan invasion. Quoting her, "I don't know and don't have the answers for the war, but I do know that killing people is not right. I think our country is just too lazy to think of other solutions." She voiced her belief that people at her high school were permitted to talk about how they felt as long as there were others who agreed with them. She denied being anti-American and denies the cries that anarchists imply support of terrorism. She'd eventually win a lawsuit against her high school, but after returning was forced out of school again a couple weeks later as peer threats of violence against her happened. Journalist Amy Goodman, as she covered this situation, would term this event as new McCarthyism. As of 2004, Katie was reported as being a successful sophomore at a university. Now, for the next 4 minutes, you'll be hearing some great work done by the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 26th in 1716, a real live lion was exhibited in the city of Boston. This is the first recorded incident of this kind in colonial America. And almost 80 years after this, the first elephant was imported from India to America, which was transported around the East Coast as a public spectacle. By 1834, a company known as the New York Menagerie toured New England with a number of, quote, exotic animals from elephants and rhinoceroses to polar bears and monkeys. Today, zoos and circuses featuring animals are extremely popular attractions despite the persistent accusations of animal brutality. Personally, I've always been curious as to why people find wild animals in small cages so entertaining. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 27th in 1868, recurring tensions between American colonists and Native Americans mounted in the Battle of Washita River. More closely resembling a massacre, the 7th U.S. Cavalry Regiment, led by George Custer, attacked Black Kettle's sleeping Cheyenne village on the Washita River. Somewhere between 1 and 200 Cheyenne were killed. About 3 months before this, 200 Cheyenne, including Black Kettle, led a raid in Kansas, killing many of the American settlers. While many American history books identify this as what provoked the Washita River Massacre, it might instead be the mass killings of Native Americans by the colonists or the exploitation of valuable land and resources that pushed the Cheyenne to rebel in the first place. What a thought. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 28th in 1785, the Treaty of Hopewell was signed between the Cherokee Nation and the United States. The treaty established equality and protection for all Cherokee people, provided that they notify the United States of any possible threats from other tribes. Article 12 in the Treaty of Hopewell said, quote, "The Indians may have full confidence in the justice of the United States respecting their interests." The treaty eventually gave rise to the Cherokee phrase, talking leaves, since they claimed that when the treaties no longer suited the Americans, they would blow away like talking leaves. This accurately describes the fate of the Cherokee, who went on to endure torture and genocide at the hands of the United States. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Kat Aaron. On this day, November 29th in 1781, the Zong Massacre claimed the lives of 132 enslaved African people. The crew of the British slave ship Zong had packed on more slaves than they had room for, causing disease and malnutrition. Upon realizing that the remaining slaves had little chance of survival, the captain ordered that the slaves be drowned in order to collect insurance on them. When they returned to England, the owners of the ship claimed the full value of the murdered slaves, who were legally considered to be physical property. This mass killing of African slaves resulted in a battle against the African slave trade of the 18th century and the eventual abolition of slavery in Britain. The Middle Passage is infamous for its inhumane conditions and the atrocious acts committed on board the ships. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
More radical history for November 29th, 1864, the Sand Creek Massacres. How the West was won by U.S. Cavalry under Colonel Shivington, a Methodist preacher, in his attack on the Cheyenne and Arapaho people at Sand Creek, Colorado. This unexpected Indian camp is slaughtered despite the white flag of surrender. Having surrounded the camp, the troops butcher over 500 unarmed men, women, and children. After this victory, these fine sons of America scalp and mutilate the bodies, cutting out the female genitalia and attaching it to their hats and sandals. Their bodies are left to rot in the sun. 9 of the 900 cavalrymen were killed, and a local newspaper called this a, quote, brilliant feat of arms, unquote, and stated that the soldiers had covered themselves with glory. No mention that they also covered themselves with female genitalia. Lastly, for November 29th, 1999, welcome to Seattle. The now infamous WTO protests begin. This week in radical history for November 30th, 1554, Roman Catholicism briefly re-enters England under the reign of Mary Tudor. She's also known as Bloody Mary, as she promptly has 300 Protestant leaders burned at the stake. In God we trust. Now, don't leave us out of the fun. Back in the New World in 1624, Richard Cornish is the first person executed for violation of U.S. anti-sodomy laws. Yep, executed. Also on this date in 1854, Fighting Mary Elsa McDowell lives. A social worker, she helped organize the first women's local union of meat cutters in 1902. Comprised mostly of women workers, the local grew to more than 1,000 members. On this day in 1900, an Irish wit, playwright, anarchist, and gay pioneer, Oscar Wilde, 46, dies in Paris, France. While dying in his apartment, Oscar takes one last look at the world he is leaving behind and declares, "This wallpaper is killing me. One of us has to go." Born in Dublin in October of 1854, this poet-writer, gay wit, published in 1890, The Soul of Man Under Socialism, which is characterized by its libertarian nonconformism. In 1895, he is condemned for 2 years of hard labor for his homosexuality. This flamboyant genius also wrote plays that perhaps perform more often than any other single modern play, the hilarious The Importance of Being Earnest. One more Oscar quote I leave you with. All authority is quite degrading. It degrades those who exercise it. It degrades those over whom it is exercised. Oscar Wilde. More awesome rebel-rousers, like in 1930, labor activist Mother Jones dies. Mary Harris Mother Jones, the founder of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, is a militant leader of miners and other union workers, dies at the age of 100. She'd be buried in Mount Olive, Illinois Cemetery. Into her 90s, Mother Jones still roamed through the hills of West Virginia, encouraging miners to organize. When a monument to her is dedicated in 1936, some 50,000 miners attend the ceremony. More rebel-rousers. Massive protests continue in Seattle on this date in 1999, and the cops start the beatdown. As Dorothy Day, who died on this date 19 years earlier, once said, quote, "The masters, whether they are priests or kings or capitalists, when they want to exploit you, the first thing they have to do is demoralize you, and they demoralize you simply by kicking you in the nuts." We march together for the 8-hour day. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced just for you at the Glee Glee Studios. I leave you now with the last part of the Against Me song recorded before they became f***ing sellout ass monkeys. Sorry, I didn't mean to offend my cousins, you monkeys. Until next week, as always, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. Thank you.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
They assemble?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that completely defeat the purpose?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This morning we focus on the issue of reframing the Palestinian narrative as the Palestinian people move forward in their quest for liberation from the Israeli occupation, and as they try to move toward their ultimate goal of achieving freedom on their own land. We have three scholars from Al Shabaka, an independent, non-partisan, non-profit organization whose mission is to educate and foster public debate on Palestinian rights and self-determination within the framework of international law. The forum you will hear was held at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. on April 10, 2018. It consisted of Nadia Hijab, co-founder and director of Al Shabaka. She is joined by Zina Aga, U.S. Policy Fellow at Al Shabaka, who is an author and journalist, as well as Yara Harwari, who was the Palestine Policy Fellow at Al Shabaka, and also a prolific writer and journalist. The forum begins with a presentation by Yara Harwari and is followed, without further introduction, by Zina Aga and finally Nadia Hijab.
Thank you, everyone, for coming here today, and thank you, Muhammad, for the introduction. As was mentioned, it's been 70 years of Nakba, and the Palestinian people, as a result, remain socially, geographically, and politically fragmented. There are Palestinians in the diaspora virtually in every corner of the world. There are Palestinian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. And over the last 6 years, since the war in Syria, an increasing number have made their way to Europe. There are also Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, and there are Palestinians in present-day Israel. This geographic fragmentation is, of course, no accident, and neither is the mainstream discourse and definitions of on who and what constitutes as Palestinian. Mainstream international, mainstream Israeli and international discourse limits Palestinians to the West Bank and Gaza, and some of the more right-wing discourse even eliminates them entirely and refers to them simply as Arabs, severing their connection with Palestine. Now, the peace negotiation discourse is slightly more inclusive, and it will include the Palestinian refugees because of UNRWA, but this does not translate into a recognition of their rights to return to their homes. Most discussions on Palestine and Palestinians on a policy level fall short on encompassing the Palestinian people in their entirety, and this is one of the major downfalls. So I'm going to briefly talk about an oft-forgotten group of Palestinians, and these are the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who today number about 1.8 million and who make up 21% of Israel's population. The Palestinian citizens of Israel were the remnants of Palestinian society in 1948, and whilst 750 of their brothers and sisters were expelled, around 150,000 remained within the borders of the new state. And these pockets in which they remained were mostly focused in the south, with a few Bedouin populations, some areas in the Triangle region, some villages in the Galilee, and a few populations remained in the cities. From 1948 until 1966, this population was placed under military rule, which restricted every aspect of their lives. And in particular, there was a lot of political repression and enforced isolation from the rest of the Arab world. The military rule ended in 1966, and 1 year later, we saw Israel occupy the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights in the Six-Day War. In Palestinian terminology or Arab terminology, this became known as the Nakba, and historic Palestine was geographically reunited. And Palestinians across the Green Line could share their experiences after being two decades apart. Naturally, over the years, relationships were re-established, and there was a relative amount of fluidity between the West Bank, Gaza, and the rest of historic Palestine. This fluidity and these relationships were once again disrupted with the building of the separation wall in the early 2000s. Now, in the early years after the establishment of the State of Israel, there was a discussion on what to do with these Palestinians who remained. There were many discussions on expulsion and population transfer, but in the end it was decided that they would be granted citizenship. Now, this was done on the understanding that this citizenship would be nominal and would never be full. A common phrase is that Palestinians in Israel are second-class citizens, but I don't think that this phrase gives a complete picture of reality. In Israel, citizenship and nationality are distinct terms and categories, unlike most countries where the two are interchangeable. So whilst there is such a thing as Israeli citizenship, there is no Israeli nationality. Rather, nationality is designated along ethnic religious lines. And actually, in Israel, there are about 137 possible nationalities, including Jewish, Arab, and Druze. These nationalities are recorded on the identity cards and in the registry databases. But because the state defines itself constitutionally as Jewish, it is therefore those with Jewish nationality who trump the non-Jewish population. So whilst European states might categorize themselves as Christian, culturally or historically, constitutionally, the rights to full citizenship are not premised on that. As the Jewish nation and the State of Israel are considered to be one of the same, the exclusion of non-Jewish citizens is a rather predictable consequence. The differentiation between citizenship and nationality allows for a very sophisticated and covert racist system, which is not necessarily detectable to the unknowing observer. And this system essentially divides people into two categories, Jews and non-Jews. And Palestinians are designated as Israeli Arabs, which not only serves as part of this binary exclusion mechanism, it also attempts to negate their Palestinian identity, whilst at the same time allowing Israel to portray itself as a multicultural and diverse state. Now, this citizenship and nationality issue has been challenged several times in Israeli courts by both Palestinian citizens and Israeli Jews, but thus far the Israeli Supreme Court have rejected all petitions to change the law on the basis that Israeli nationality would technically open up inclusion for non-Jewish citizens and would challenge the Zionist underpinning of Israel as a Jewish nation state. Now, most of the Palestinian citizens of Israel live in Arab-only villages and towns, with a few living in the so-called mixed cities. And it's important to note that the segregation of these populations is neither accidental nor a natural residential pattern. The villages that survived the ethnic cleansing in 1948 had many of their lands appropriated and expropriated, and expansion since has not been permitted. As a result, these Arab towns and villages suffer from severe overcrowding with no opportunity of relief through development or growth. And in addition, since 1948, not a single new Arab town or village has been built. So essentially, the goal of the Israeli state with regards to these Palestinians is the same goal as with other Palestinian communities, to squeeze as many Palestinian Arabs into as little space as possible. If Palestinians leave their towns or villages of origin, they are restricted from purchasing or leasing land through two main mechanisms. Firstly, admissions committees, and secondly, the discriminatory policies pursued by the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, and the state authorities. The admissions committees have been continuously upheld by the High Court despite challenges against it. Basically, what they are is rural communities which set up admissions committees that assess the social suitability of potential residents. So in this way, Palestinian applicants can be legally rejected on the very basis that they're not Jewish. So in practice, this has had very devastating consequences for Palestinian spaces in 1948 borders, Israel proper. In the Galilee, which is in northern Israel, where there is a Palestinian majority population, this has led to furious attempts by the government to Judaize the region, which includes circling Palestinian villages with Jewish-Israeli settlements to prevent geographic contiguity. The Galilee also reveals the Israeli state's preoccupation with demographics, and in particular its fear of the rising Palestinian population. And this fear has also played out in the south, in the Negev, where there is a continued displacement and forced relocation of tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins. Now, in order to counter these racist policies and to challenge their overall treatment by the state, Palestinians in Israel have created a civil society space that is pretty much separate from its Jewish-Israeli counterpart. Palestinian civil society initially developed to make up for the services that the state failed to provide its Palestinian citizens. However, over the last two decades, there's been a burgeoning of civil society organizations working explicitly on political mobilization and Arab-Palestinian identity and cultural preservation. Now, these activities are wide-ranging and diverse, and they include art, cinema, theater, and they're all very political because in their very nature they express a Palestinian identity and a Palestinian narrative. Some more perhaps interesting recent political developments among this community include the publication of a series of documents called the Future Vision Documents. These were published between 2006 and 2007 and came out of a political context of total frustration from being marginalized from the Israeli state and being marginalized at the same time from the Palestinian national movement. So what these documents were was a collective effort from politicians, intellectuals, civil society. And basically they laid out social and political demands of the Palestinian community in Israel. They put forward a cohesive Palestinian narrative. These documents didn't present new ideas, but rather what they did was consolidate what Palestinian academics, organizers, and activists have been calling for decades. And they had a very clear picture of an imagined future. This included equal rights, equal and full rights within the state of Israel, and that the state would become a state for all its citizens, ending the occupation of the 1967 territories, as well as the right of return for refugees. Now, unfortunately, these documents haven't gained much traction, but if developed, I think, and worked on with Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, and the diaspora, they could really lay the foundation for a collective Palestinian vision for the future. Another interesting political development took the form of the joint list in the 2015 Knesset elections, the Knesset being the Israeli parliament. Now, this was the first time all major Arab parties in Israel joined together on a single list. Israel has an electoral list system. And the reason they did it in 2015 was because they were trying to prevent Netanyahu from forming a government. The joint list was headed and is headed by Ayman Ode, and they won a total of 13 seats, making it the third largest party in the Knesset. And they managed to mobilize about two-thirds of the Palestinian citizens to vote, which was quite phenomenal because usually many Palestinians within Israel take a boycott stance towards Knesset elections. During the elections itself, when it was apparent that the joint list was gaining in popularity, Netanyahu actually released a video on social media in which he said the following: "The right-wing government is in danger. Arab voters are heading to the polls stations in droves. Left-wing NGOs are bringing them in buses." Now, this discourse might be very uncomfortable to us, but it's actually quite common to hear in Israeli politics, where Palestinian citizens are likened to animals or a sort of hegemonic mass that can be sort of driven or taken on buses. Now, the joint list hoped that their increase in seats would help them be able to prevent racist bills, such as the 2012 Power Plan, which I'll explain shortly, which seeks to relocate 90,000 Palestinian Bedouins in the south. My analysis is that the joint list is not naive. It doesn't think that it can drastically change the system from within, but I think it does hope that it could alleviate some of the hardships of daily life for Palestinians in Israel, and also highlight and bring attention to their specific case. Unfortunately, however, Netanyahu cemented a coalition deal that would see the formation of Israel's most right-wing government to date. The aforementioned government power plan received a lot of attention in 2013, particularly because on the 30th of November, the day before the Knesset's second vote on the plan, a collective day of rage was organized by activists around the country and across the Green Line. Demonstrations were held in Gaza, Bir Sabah, Ramallah, Jerusalem, Yaffa, Bethlehem, and the Galilee, all in solidarity with the Nakab, the Negev Bedouin, facing displacement. These collective political manifestations across the Green Line were met with the same repression from the Israeli authorities, and it's this repression that unifies the Palestinian experience. Now, just a final point, because I'm running out of time. Another example of political solidarity across the Green Line is that of BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement. And this has recently been developing a lot amongst the Palestinian community in Israel, and particularly there are a lot of conversations about normalization. Normalization here refers to a concept that was developed by the movement, which argues that Israel must not be treated like any other country or enjoy normal relations. Practically, this means not having relations with Israeli initiatives, institutions, organizations, and so on, that are not openly against Israeli oppression and colonization. For Palestinians in Israel, this can obviously be a huge challenge, as interactions with the state and its institutions are unavoidable. So specific guidelines have been developed that recognizes the difference between necessary relations and normalizing relations. For example, funding from the state for cultural projects constitutes as normalization, as it's possible to get funding elsewhere. But going to a state school is not, because it's necessary as part of daily life. But I can go into BDS further in the question time. Now, just to end, my sort of brief intervention here was not to isolate this fragment of the Palestinian people from the other Palestinians, but rather to highlight the nuances and specific characteristics that they face under an overall system of Israeli oppression, which affects all Palestinians wherever they might be. And I really think this should be part of our reframing effort to expand the discussion of Palestine and Palestinians beyond the 1967 borders, particularly this year as we approach the 70th anniversary of the Nakba and we remain geographically fragmented and still far from achieving full rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Yara, and thank you, Mohammed, and other organisers at the Palestine Centre for having us here today. So as was mentioned at the beginning and repeated by Yara, next month we do commemorate 70 years since the loss of the Palestinian homeland and the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinian Arabs from Palestine, who are still awaiting their return, entrapped in a political limbo. And, of course, last year marked 50 years since the Nexus, since the 1967 war, and the reality that between the river and the sea, Israel controls everyone and everything in it in one single stratified system. In the time that I have, though, I'd really like to discuss the status of Jerusalem and the annexation attempts that are happening in the West Bank. not only because the imminent move of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem next month, but also because Israel's brazen attempts of the West Bank, among other factors, mean that Palestine really is facing an existential moment. In the 50 years since Israel has captured Jerusalem, Israel has limited Palestinian power, ownership, and habitation in the Jerusalem area on the one hand, while increasing Jewish-Israeli presence and control on the other. While Jerusalem was the only officially annexed part of Palestinian territory since 1967, the nationalist right wing in Israel has long since advocated the full annexation of the West Bank, otherwise known as the occupied Palestinian territories. And since over the last year, the current Benjamin Netanyahu government has presented a slew of plans, resolutions, and bills which would tighten Israel's grip on Jerusalem. This is, of course, elevated by Trump's green light, but Israeli politicians, administrators, and planners have also presented thousands of housing units to be built in the Jerusalem area and also deep into the occupied Palestinian territory. Now, of course, as we know, the establishment of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories is a violation of Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and the larger Israeli scheme to annex the West Bank requires a demographic majority and, of course, the expansion of the settlements that we see all over the West Bank. The multitude of bills introduced, such as the now-shelved Greater Jerusalem Bill and the Ariel Bill, which, of course, extends Israeli law into the universities and the settlements, have usually been introduced by the hawkish right-wing Justice Minister Eilat Shaked from the Jewish Home Party. They mostly, on the whole, seek to apply Israeli law to the settlements, which would essentially blur the green line even further and bring the settlements into the fold of the Israeli state, amounting, in other words, to an annexation. An annexation would irrevocably sever Palestinians from their capital, Jerusalem. It would Judaize the city demographically and spatially, and it would colonize the narrowest part of the West Bank, making a contiguous Palestinian state all but impossible. Now, fundamental to both of these outcomes is the proposed annexation of the larger city settlement known as called Ma'al Adumim, and the strip of land that connects it to Jerusalem, which is known as the E1 corridor. Ma'al Adumim, for those who don't know, is located next to Jericho in the occupied Palestinian territory, and it functions as a Jewish suburb of Jerusalem. It boasts a population of about 40,000 people, and demographically its inclusion in Jerusalem would drastically increase the number of Jewish Israelis who are considered residents of Jerusalem. But it's intended, and when it was really built with this intention to achieve two overarching goals. First, to strategically penetrate deep into the occupied Palestinian territories, and second, to consolidate Israel's grip on Jerusalem. Around 70% of Ma'al Adumim's residents commute daily to Jerusalem for work, barely noticing the crossing of the Green Line, of course, a privilege reserved only to Jewish Israeli citizens. And Ma'al Adumim, along with the neighboring settlements in Palestinian territory, which have sprung up around Ma'al Adumim, they form a sweeping built-up area which interpose the Palestinian landscape and isolate Palestinians from their capital, Jerusalem. It is, in other words, the jewel of the settlement crown of the Israeli colonizing project. Now, any annexation of Ma'al Adumim or any other part of the West Bank would depend on the acquisition of a strategically significant parcel of land called the E1 corridor, which is only measures about 12 kilometers squared, and it's located in Area C, which is Israeli controlled. Its primary objective in acquiring E1 is to really secure Ma'al Adumim's continuity with Israel and Jerusalem by creating an urban Jewish bloc in the West Bank. This would bolster Israel's grip on East Jerusalem by dwarfing its neighboring Palestinian districts with Jewish neighborhoods, while also applying the final nail in the coffin to this two-state solution. Now, recognizing the spatial and political difficulties of annexing this parcel of land, Israel is building the Eastern Ring Road, otherwise dubbed as the Apartheid Road, but due to the wall that runs down its middle, which separates Israeli from Palestinian motorists. And it's intended to facilitate Palestinian travel between the North and South West Bank to ensure a transportational contiguity. But it's also meant to better connect Israeli settlements to Jerusalem while severing Palestinian motorists from accessing Jerusalem. The implication of the road is devastating to Palestinians' freedom of movement from their future capital. For many Palestinians in the occupied territory, Jerusalem is their economic and cultural centre of life. The building of the separation wall over a decade ago through parts of the West Bank and around the existing settlements have already denied Palestinians access to Jerusalem. Palestinians holding West Bank IDs can no longer do business, study, receive medical care, or visit friends and family without permission from the Israeli security apparatus. Moreover, the religious significance of such an annexation should not be downplayed. Jerusalem is home to many of the most religious sites for Muslim and Christian Palestinians, including the Noble Sanctuary, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Annexation would only exacerbate the religious restrictions imposed on Palestinians who are denied rights to worship freely at their holy sites. Most significantly, however, and something I would really like to dwell on in the time that I have, is implementing any annexation or settlement in the E1 area would require the immediate expulsion of the Bedouin Palestinians living on the land, another violation of international law. At present, there are approximately 2,700 Palestinian Bedouins, half of whom are children in the Ma'al Adumim vicinity. The majority of these communities come from the Jehelin tribe. The Israeli authority have deliberately deprived Jehelin of access to their most basic services, such as water and electricity, which makes their existence on that land intolerable. They are not allowed to work or build on the land, and the military limits their access to their allotted farmland, which of course is used for grazing their stock, which forces them to depend on purchasing costly fodder for their sheep. And herders have been obliged in recent years to sell their livestock, with the result that only 30% of the residents continue to earn a living from livestock. The rest work as labourers, usually in the nearby settlements. And under the current E1 plans, the Jehelin are to be expelled and relocated in three townships. This forces a lifestyle onto the Bedouin that runs anathema to their nomadic existence. In the context of a military occupation, any transfer of protected persons, such as these communities, which includes the confiscation of their land or the destruction of property by the occupying power, represents a gross breach of international law. By extension, any military plan which is intended to permanently relocate occupied people is considered a war crime. Yet despite the clear international legal framework condemning these practices, Israel's attempt to relocate the Bedouins does continue, using Israeli domestic law as a tool to obfuscate Bedouin and Palestinian claims to the land. This all ties into decades of established Israeli policy, which is characterized by land confiscation, creeping annexation, demographic manipulation, and population transfer. And of course, this is not unique to the Bedouins or to the Palestinians living in the West Bank, as Yara mentioned. The Bedouin communities living in the Naqab or the Negev, in the Negev Desert, are also living in very precarious condition in so-called unrecognized villages. And despite being Israeli citizens, they are a perpetual threat of expulsion. And I'm thinking most vividly here of the Umm al-Hiran village, which is intended to be cleared of its Bedouin Palestinians, and a Jewish settlement called Hiran to be built in its space. Population transfer, namely the removal of Palestinian Arabs and settlement of Jewish Israelis in their place, really isn't a new phenomenon. And it lies at the root of the Palestine-Israel conflict as we understand it. While Israeli annexation attempts should be understood as a thirst for Palestinian land, forced population transfer of Palestinians should be understood as a desire for an ethnically homogenous Jewish population. The Nakba, or catastrophe, again denoting 750,000 Palestinians being removed of their land, cannot and should not be understood as a single moment in history. Rather, as the Bedouins in E1 and Umm al-Hiran will attest, it's a process of ongoing dispossession and displacement. This is what cannot be forgotten and should not be underestimated. It is in this context that we should understand the return march that has been taking place in Gaza over the last 2 weeks. Since the 30th of March, Israel has killed more than 31 Palestinian peaceful demonstrators and wounded more than 2,500, including children and young people. The Israeli authorities have done this openly and without shame. The threat from these protesters lies precisely in the indisputable fact that the Palestinians have not forgotten where they are from, nor that they have an indisputable and inalienable right to return to their historic homeland. It is unsurprising, then, that Israel has responded in the only way it knows how, through brute force. Annexation and population transfer in and around in the Jerusalem area is merely the latest instalment of the Israelization project to dominate and control the land of historic Palestine. Until this reality is reckoned with by the international community and its policymakers, the situation can only get worse before it gets better. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mohammed, and thank you very much to the Palestine Center and Jerusalem Fund for organizing this event. And it's always a real pleasure for me to come back to one of my homes, as I call one of my intellectual homes, as I consider it. So I'm really happy to be here with my colleagues. So you've heard from Zina and Diara about the situation on the ground and the continuous process of decolonization that's been going on since 1948 and that actually for which the ground was laid at the turn of the century. I want to focus in my talk on the narrative and discourse that we use to describe this struggle. And as part of that, I want to also emphasize, discuss the importance of emphasizing not just what Palestinians are fighting against, but what they are fighting for. And finally, I also want to touch on some of the sources of power that Palestinians have to achieve these goals. So when it comes to the narrative, there's a lot of debate, particularly in academic circles, about what framework of analysis, how should we understand the Palestinian question and what happened? Is it a question of settler colonialism or ethnic cleansing or racial discrimination or apartheid? In fact, you can make a strong case for any one of these and many more frameworks of analysis. But it is important to agree on a common framing because without it, there's a lack of clarity about the strategies that are needed to succeed. My Al-Shabaka colleague Ingrid Jadodat and I reviewed a number of frameworks in a recent Al-Shabaka policy paper, and we identified apartheid as the most strategic framework that should be applied to this struggle, to this question. In other words, it's strategic because it is most useful to the Palestinian struggle for rights. For example, the settler colonial framework, which is beloved of many academics, is strategic in many ways, but it was not expressly prohibited by international law at the time that Israel was established. So this means that it would only be applicable to Israel's settler colonial enterprise in the occupied territories under international law. And it could not be used to address the rights of the refugees or equality for the Palestinian citizens of Israel. In addition, although settler colonialism was prohibited, it was not criminalized. In the case of Palestine, you can make the case that the settler colonial society, that apartheid began when the settler colonial society transformed into the state of Israel. So Israel actually bears legal responsibility for acts of apartheid against all Palestinians, including the refugees, the citizens of Israel, and those under occupation. Now, there's much more on this in the UN report by Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley that was withdrawn under pressure. There's also more in my Al-Shabaka paper with Ingrid. And as I think Mohammed mentioned, there is a sign-up sheet at the door. So if you want to be on our email list and to get regular Palestinian analysis, please do sign up and check out this paper and others online. So if we can establish the apartheid framework as our common framing of what we are fighting against, that would be a major source of power for the Palestinian people and for the Palestine solidarity movement. Now, if that's what we're fighting against, what are we fighting for? And this is where the discussion slips always into a debate about one state versus two states. Is that what we should be pursuing? Is that what we should be going for? But let's think about that for a moment. In terms of achieving Palestinian rights, what would a one state do that two states would not? See, he agrees with me. I like that. The vision of a secular democratic state in all of Palestine, as set out by the PLO in 1968, has always been more compelling for the Palestinian people than that of two states. I mean, we need to recognize this. Through a single state, Palestinians would exercise their right to self-determination in the entirety of the land that had been Palestine under the Mandate, alongside the Jews living there with equal rights for all. But when we come to discuss the two-state vision, it's important to discuss between the one that was set. It's important, to distinguish between that the vision that was set out in 1988, when the Palestinian National Council adopted it, and the disaster that was set out in the Oslo Accords. When it was adopted in 1988, the two-state solution was seen as a pragmatic, doable recognition of reality. Palestinians would exercise the right to self-determination through a sovereign state that would secure the equal rights of its citizens. The 1988 Palestinian National Council resolution also upheld the UN resolutions regarding the rights of the Palestinian refugees. And the struggle for two states does not mean forsaking the vital struggle for the equality of the Palestinian citizens of Israel. In any case, Oslo doomed any kind of rights-based project from the start. The Palestinian leadership was willing to sacrifice refugee rights. There was no reference to the Palestinian citizens of Israel. And as for the Israeli side, even the so-called great peacemaker Yitzhak Rabin made it clear that Palestinians would have an entity that was less than a state, and that the Israeli security border would be located in the Jordanian Valley, i.e. extending over the entire West Bank. But, and here's the thing, and here's why I want to discuss the sources of power that are needed. Had the Palestinians built up enough power to ensure that this two-state solution had stayed faithful to its original framing, then this approach could have fulfilled the right to self-determination and return, just as the one state would have. Plus, and this is a very important point, fulfilling Palestinian rights needs some of the sources of power that associated with the state system. For example, under international law, states believe that Israel has no right to annex and colonize East Jerusalem. In fact, it has no right to West Jerusalem. Under international law, obviously, the settlements are illegal. These are sources of power that should not be given up until Palestinian goals are achieved. So just to summarize that piece of the discussion, either state outcome, one or two, could be made to achieve Palestinian rights if there are sufficient power to do so, if there is sufficient power to do so. And it's useful to remember that this was the smart strategic choice of the founders of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. Recognizing that the Palestinian people had very little power at present, they focused on rights instead of on political outcomes, because there was no power to actually influence or realize a political outcome. So the BDS call is for the realization of self-determination through freedom from occupation, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and justice for Palestinian refugees in fulfilling their rights of return. Freedom, justice, equality. This is how the BDS movement reached a broad spectrum of Palestinian society and a very broad spectrum of international solidarity activists for Palestinian rights. And they built a considerable source of power by giving the Palestine solidarity movement specific actions they could take. Now, when it comes to the question of narrative, in my view, the three goals of the BDS, when we talk about BDS, we often talk about the strategy and the tactics, but we rarely talk about the goals. The three goals of BDS capture very well what the Palestinian narrative should emphasize, not just what Palestinians are against, Israel's violations of international law and apartheid, but also what Palestinians are for. And Israel continues to dominate the narrative in the West, despite inroads by Palestinians and by the solidarity movement. This dominance of the narrative can be challenged by a narrative that communicates what Palestinians are for until the time comes for a political outcome. And That unifying narrative already exists. It's freedom, it's justice, it's equality. This speaks to goals all human beings can aspire to. It speaks to the reality of each segment of the Palestinian people, whether they're under occupation in Israel or in refugee camps and exiles. What this narrative would make clear is that human rights advocates support BDS because they want to achieve freedom, justice, and equality. They are against apartheid because they want to achieve freedom, justice, and equality. So far, I think that getting the narrative right would be a major source of power. So in my last few remarks, I want to touch on the sources of power available to the Palestinians. I've already mentioned three. The first, the fact that what Israel is doing is illegal under international law. Second, which is a source of power that the Palestinian leadership should be using but is not. Second is the strategic use of BDS. That's a very good source of power. And third, a narrative that communicates what the Palestinian people are for, not just what they're against. There is a fourth source of power. There are many, but I'm just singling out these four. There's a fourth source of power, which is the ability and determination of the Palestinian people to mobilize for their rights over the last 100 years. There is, of course, everyday resistance to stay on the land, as Palestinians try to stay on their land, which is called sumud, which is Arabic for steadfastness. There's a continuous flowering in culture and the art, both within historic Palestine as well as amongst refugees and exiles, as Palestinians tell their story. But if you think about it, looking back, every 10 or 20 years, there's a major uprising or mobilization. Think back, to the great Palestinian uprising of 36-39, which stands out in Palestinian history. And even though by now it has failed, still the effort to organize Palestinian refugees in exile into the PLO, into a national liberation movement, was another major mobilization. And despite repeated setbacks and many mistakes, the PLO did impose itself and its advocacy for Palestinian rights on the world stage. There's been other mobilizations. In 1976, the Palestinian citizens of Israel rose up in Lande. Even as Israel drove the PLO away from the borders, all the borders abutting Palestine with its invasion of Lebanon in 1982, during that time, a new wave of struggle began to be built for Palestinian rights by the Palestinians under occupation, and that led to the First Intifada in 87. The launch of the BDS movement in 2005 was another mobilization because it mobilized international civil society around targeted peaceful actions that could be taken against Israeli policies. Last summer, there was an uprising by Jerusalemites against with support of the Palestinian citizens of Israel in mass peaceful protests that stopped Israel's attempt to change the status quo at Al-Aqsa Mosque. And as Zina mentioned, since March 30th of this year, there's been the Great March of Return, spearheaded by the Palestinians besieged in Gaza, and at very great risk to life and limb, which has imposed itself on the world stage despite a multitude of other crises. So even though Palestinians have not been able to achieve human rights in the land of Palestine, it's very clear that steadfastness and mobilization will continue to challenge Israel's policies of apartheid, as well as the current Palestinian leadership's defeatism and collaboration, and the international community's acquiescence in this injustice until justice is done. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for a wonderful talk. We'll have now take some questions. So do you have any questions?
I have just a small one for you, Yara. When you talked about the 130-plus designations of nationalities in Israel, can you tell us how many of those break up Jews? I mean, is Jewish one, or is there Ashkenazi, Sephardi, that sort of thing? And then a second question, can you give us the population numbers on Mizrahi Palestinians in Israel and West Bankers in Gaza together versus the Jewish Israeli population?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question because I think I know where you're going with that. So the 137 different nationalities, the Jewish nationality is not broken up into Ashkenazi, Mizrahi, and Sephardi. And the reason for that is because they want to maintain it sort of legally and constitutionally, they want to maintain a unified Jewish nationality. Socially and politically, that's a bit different because, of course, there is an elitism in Israel in which Ashkenazi Jews, which are white European Jews, are at the top of the level, and then Jews of color are sort of below that, and then we have Palestinian citizens of Israel right at the bottom. Now, this second part of your question is interesting because, in reality, Israel is actually an Arab country, and that sounds quite strange, but that's because 50% of Israel's population is Mizrahi Jewish, which is Jews from who originate from Arab countries. Then you take 21% who are Palestinians. So really, you're left with 29-ish percent who are Ashkenazi European Jews. So the European Jews are actually in the minority. Now, from the river to the sea, if we're including the West Bank, Palestinians and Israeli Jews are pretty much equal in number, and that was the case at the end of 2017. And that's quite worrying for Israel because Israel is very, very obsessed with demographics. So we're looking at nearly 7 million for each Palestinians, which includes West Bank Palestinians, Gazans, Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then Jewish Israelis. But then if you break down the Jewish Israeli population, you know, that's divided along, you know, different ethnic lines as well. So it's very troubling for Israel to see this sort of demographic change, and that's one of the reasons why it does employ this system of apartheid, because it has to control a population which is not in the minority, which with, you know, other settler colonial enterprises, they were able to control the indigenous population because they were such a small number. But for the Palestinians, they're now equal in number within historic Palestine. I mean, they're double that if you include the diaspora. And you saw that practice being you saw that also being practiced in South Africa. The white South Africans had to employ a tactic of apartheid because black South Africans were in the majority. So I think it's very important to keep in mind demographics, and thank you for bringing it up. I hope that answered your question.
You have been listening to a forum consisting of Yara Harwari, Zina Aga, and Nadia Hijab from the Palestinian think tank Al-Shabaka, recorded at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. طفلة تمتطي فوزا قزح
to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A victim of the Manchester Arena terror attack calls for MI5 to be prosecuted for negligence. Litany of failures, which again and again and again, we're talking 7-7, we're talking the Westminster Bridge attack, the London Bridge attack, the Manchester attack, again and again and again have allowed bombers to carry on unhindered. is MI5's work impossible, like looking for a needle in a haystack? If so, why are we paying them any money? The cyber war against you being waged using your taxpayers' money. A former GCHQ officer explains methods by which the deep state, operating in the shadows, has taken away any oversight whatsoever of the intelligence services, even from the Queen.
Off with his head.
Also, following on from last week, other high-profile political targets who died in car crashes. We get the latest on the taking offline and attempts to prosecute the world's most courageous publisher and investigative journalist. Yes, we're talking about Julian Assange. Almost unreported, this one. The US refuses to vote for a UN motion condemning Nazi war criminals and neo-Nazis today. That's Martin Summers' tour of the world's hotspots. He's able to do if he wishes. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM Tuesday at noon. This week we look at Westmoreland House, some artwork which has been done to celebrate the beginning of the end of an eyesore on Stokes Croft. The demolition's just started. There's some art available if you're interested, some artworks. On that, a screen print about it. And one of the people who started the Greenham Common protests in Berkshire in the 1980s, Fran Diarth. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to Dialect, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. right now. But Martin, I think we better start with this attack, the Manchester Arena attack. I mean, what's your general take home from what happened that day?
Well, I think the most significant thing that people haven't really picked up on, or they ought to pick up on, is that the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, or the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, basically were headquartered in Manchester during the 1980s when they were being shipped to Afghanistan to fight the Red Army, having been trained basically by our own intelligence services and special forces.
In what way were they related to Libya then?
Well, because
they're going over to Afghanistan.
Well, the bomber, the alleged bomber, if we can call him that, was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, as was his father, who made a statement in Tripoli about what had happened, saying that the whole thing was a setup and that the whole thing was being orchestrated from inside the Western intelligence services. Now, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is very significant because the Libyans provided by far the
You're
largest...
You're talking about Ramadan Abadi, yeah? This is the guy who was in the Islamic Fighting Group. We know he was working for MI6, so it's not really much of an excuse to have an MI6 agent and his son carries out a bombing, and the intelligence services are telling us they didn't know anything about it.
Well, I mean, what the father was saying before he was disappeared, and we don't know where, I'm not quite sure what's happened to him, is that he was in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. He'd been working, because they've been working intimately with MI6 for years and years and years, going back to the 1980s, both in opposition to Gaddafi and, of course, operating in Afghanistan in the 80s. And, of course, lots of them were then transferred to Syria after Gaddafi was overthrown in Libya. And people have got to know the background and the history. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are Al-Qaeda Libya, but they have an intimate relationship with MI6 and, of course, with MI5 indirectly. So the idea that these people are just random is just wrong. They are there, based in Manchester, because Manchester was basically made as the ex-Libyan place where they were going to be. So all these people from Libya lived in Manchester with the full understanding of the Western intelligence services, particularly our own in Britain.
Well, he was detained by the militia, Ramadan Abadi, Salman Abadi's father.
Yeah.
Not been heard of since.
Well, indeed. And, of course, he was saying that the whole thing is actually orchestrated because he's an insider. He's a Libyan Islamic Fighting Group guy, and he also works with MI6. And he immediately pointed the finger at MI6 as being behind the bombing. So when we're talking about MI5 being lacking in capacity to stop bombs and all the rest of it, you're missing the point. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is a terrorist organisation, but it's been set up, run and directed by MI6 since the 1980s. So we're talking 50 years of relations with MI6.
So is there actually any evidence that Salman Abedi, CCTV, that sort of thing, was even at the Manchester Arena?
Well, these questions start to emerge, don't they? What actually happened here?
Well, the answer is no. What the security services have released are several pictures with all of the edges blacked out. So it's a picture of Salman Abedi with a suitcase of some sort, and all you can see around the edges is black. So it doesn't actually show any evidence.
Unless you've got a time-stamped video, then it doesn't mean anything.
These were taken apparently in a lift in the centre, but they blacked everything else out because they didn't want to show other people's faces.
Well, unless you've got a time-stamped video, it doesn't mean anything, does it? I mean, people think they saw the bombers on 7-7 on video, but it was from the dry run the previous week.
There was nothing shown around the Salman Abedi's body other than black, so you couldn't see anyone else's, not even parts of a lift. It was really impossible to see where he was.
Well, it may well be that the whole thing is a false flag terrorist attack, or it may be blowback. You know, you could argue, I think people on RT have argued, that basically you shouldn't have been in bed with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. Looks what happens when you work with these kind of people. They were anti-Gaddafi, they were anti-Russian, therefore they were on our side even though they're Al-Qaeda. But of course it could be blowback, but I think it's more suspicious than that. Orchestrating the whole of the strategy of tension before 9/11 and after 9/11 has been Western Intelligence Services, in which MI6 are big players. They're as big players in many ways as the CIA.
But that's ridiculous. I mean, surely our own security services wouldn't get involved in an attack which killed 22 of our own people.
They would if it then led to a situation where everybody's screaming, oh, we're being bombed here, give some more resources to the security services so they can carry on doing other things elsewhere. Don't forget that the purpose of all of this is to carry on wars in the Middle East and elsewhere for resources. And the 9/11 attack itself looks like a false flag. The bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980 was a false flag. The bombs in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972 were false flag, according to the Italian and Irish police in both cases. Now, in actual fact, unless you know the history of Western Intelligence Service false flag terrorism, you might say, surely the intelligence services are trying to catch the bombers. Not necessarily. Not necessarily at all.
Well, there was a whole list of problems with, and it'd be interesting to see, you know, what the Intelligence and Security Committee say about any of these, and we'll come to that in a minute, but we had helplines inoperative. Actually, that day, there was supposed to be an automatic helpline, but it didn't give any useful information. And since Vodafone have apologised to the Home Office and saying, well, we thought we were going to have a helpline, it was supposed to be ready, but unfortunately on the night of the attack and the next day, it didn't work.
Well, interestingly enough, the Fire Brigade are also complaining because they weren't given access to the scene. Now, that possibly means that somebody is cleaning the scene to make sure that outsiders can't see what's actually happened.
Is that there was supposed to be another bomber or something, so the fire brigade were told, hang on a minute, just stay back and don't come near the attack scene. Also, another thing which happens often is these false alarm of second terrorists, giving the police and private security total control of the terror attack crime scene, which is what you've just said there. Key eyewitnesses are not interviewed, or frozen out or neglected. Now, we heard, didn't we, from Dawn Waddy, who said that she saw a very suspicious woman who wasn't actually at, who was at the concert sitting next to her, but wasn't paying any attention to it and kept looking at where the bomb eventually went off. She had a rucksack that she kept fiddling with, and she wasn't actually watching the concert. She had no interest in it, and she had some sort of foreign accent.
Well, I would make the point, the fundamental point, that we've got overwhelming evidence from the past that NATO intelligence services have engaged in terrorist provocation.
So what about the security people
on this occasion,
in charge?
I mean,
it does seem that they ignored warnings. They, private security at the arena could actually be potentially a terror vector.
Well, indeed, when you privatise security in things like airports, ICTS, an Israeli firm connected to Mossad, controlled all three airports on 9/11, where hijackers supposedly got on planes, and also control Schiphol Airport today, where the underpants bomber and the shoe bomber were both allowed on the plane without being checked. Now, in actual fact, most terrorism is orchestrated by security forces. Some of it is random, but most of it isn't.
Salman Abedi, who's the alleged bomber, I would suggest most likely Patsy for this attack.
Mm-hmm.
He was reported to the anti-terror hotline several times, apparently. Apparently, he was well known, obviously, to the security services through his father working for mm-hmm. them. And yet there was nothing done to stop him.
Well, what you need to do if you're...
What's the point of phoning the anti-terror hotline about somebody who's about to commit a terrorist attack?
Well, I would suggest to anybody listening to this show, and the point I made in Birmingham Central Mosque some years ago, is if you suspect somebody is a terrorist, you shouldn't contact the anti-terror hotline. You should contact the local police, because they can then filter what's going on. The fact of the matter is, I'm afraid, that intelligence services, the higher up you go, are suspects. And therefore, you shouldn't be working directly.
We'll be coming to that in a minute. So basically, phone 101, folks. Don't phone the anti-terror hotline.
Quite.
Rather, potentially anyway, a waste of time. Anyway, somebody who was really irritated about this whole business, he was severely injured in the attack. His name's Robbie Potter, and he thinks that MI5 should be sued over the revelations, that they knew so much and been following this guy, and he had so many connections, and they've been warned so many times. He's wondering what on earth is the point of MI5. But anyway, he's saying they should be taken to court. And here he is speaking to the BBC's Judith Moritz.
Abedi was never referred to the government's anti-radicalisation programme, Prevent, and was able to visit another extremist in prison. Robbie Potter was gravely injured in the attack, left in a coma with shrapnel removed from his heart. Today, he's on the mend, but angry at the revelations.
This is something that could have been stopped. End of. This did not have to happen. Every alarm bell was ringing.
You feel let down?
I am a bit, yeah. There was enough warning signs. It wasn't just like one like hoax call to him. Enough warning signs. They should be took to court. Yeah, I've said it. They should be took to court now. They're just as guilty. That could have been stopped.
MI5.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an absolutely fair comment from that gentleman. But I come back to what we were saying earlier. The real problem is that the intelligence structure is implicated in Islamist terrorism and has been since the 1980s.
What Robbie Potter is saying there is this attack could have been stopped and should have been stopped. So why wasn't it? I mean, what we have with the security services, Martin, is a whole bunch of secret officers who are able to be interviewed by the Intelligence and Security Committee behind closed doors, but it's all totally anonymous and they don't face prosecution. We also saw a story earlier on this year which said that the MI5 are actually allowed to break the law and commit crimes with impunity.
Well, and anybody thought that anything else was the case, I've got a suspension bridge to tell you. The Western intelligence services, including MI6, the CIA, etc., are extremely iffy organisations. They always have been. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is based in Manchester because MI6 based them there in the 1980s. And that, what are we on now? 2018? That's nearly 50 years ago. And they've been working with them very closely all that time, which is why they know everything about this guy, and they didn't stop it because they didn't want to stop it.
So,
and it's not even clear he did it, as you said earlier.
The story is in The Guardian from the 2nd of March this year. MI5 agents can commit crimes in the UK, the government reveals, and the officers obviously as well. Secret order on authorised criminality by spies has been made public after a legal battle by rights groups. MI5 officers are allowed to carry out criminal activity. The government's acknowledged for the first time. The Prime Minister on Thursday was forced to publish the text of a direction to the Investigatory Powers Commissioner's Office, the spying watchdog on governing security service participation in criminality. It instructs the IPCO to oversee the participation of MI5 agents in criminal activity, which was previously conducted by the now defunct Office of the Intelligence Services Commissioner under a secret order referred to as the Third Direction.
Well, the fact is that they've been engaged in criminal activities for years.
And I'll put that
it's
up
hardly,
on
a... It's hardly surprising. This is just a bit of an admission.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But anyway, let's hear from the Home Affairs correspondent of the BBC, Dominic Cacciani. I suppose before that, we should give a kind of, a warning, really, saying, well, you know, take this with a pinch of salt. After we spoke to the former special branch officer and army officer, Charles Shoebridge, Martin, who said that actually the London media's Home Affairs correspondents are basically press officers for MI5.
That's right, it's total integration.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you don't end up being in that position if you're going to be problematic from the point of view of the securocrats that run things.
OK, so problematic. Let's have a listen to Dominic Cacciani now on BBC's Five Live yesterday.
What the Intelligence and Security Committee has said today very explicitly is that, in their view, MI5 has admitted that it made a mistake in not tracking Salman Abedi, the Manchester bomber. Let me just take you back a little bit, because I think there's a bit of history around the Abedi case. Mm-hmm. He was initially a person of concern to MI5. That he first came onto their radar in 2014 when they received some intelligence which suggested that the then teenager was of a cause of concern. They had a look at him. They decided actually that at that time he wasn't at the threshold to be some kind of potential terrorist in the making. That happens with an awful lot of people who come across MI5's radar. So they, in their view, they can't justify spending any more time on that individual because there are, to be frank, bigger fish to fry. What then happened, I think, is very, very interesting. They started to receive bits and pieces of possible intelligence in relation to Salman Abedi, and a decision was taken to review his case about whether or not, effectively, to reopen his file and turn him into one of their priority cases to look at. But the review meeting, which would have taken that decision, wasn't actually scheduled until actually after the bombing took place. And critically, Abedi, who's believed to have received his bomb-making training from Islamic State or another group in Libya, he flew back into the country days before the attack. There was no flag against him so that he would be stopped at the airport and questioned and his devices cloned and examined. So there was a potential opportunity missed there. The security service have effectively conceded to MPs that port stop probably should have been in place. Now, whether or not it would have stopped an attack, given how close it was a matter of days later that he built his bomb and carried it out to his attack. We don't know. But another key piece of the picture, which became much clearer today, is the fact that Abedi, we knew already that he had visited a known jailed extremist in prison in the UK, a guy from Manchester called Abdul Rauf Abdallah. And the committee makes clear today that visit was not passed on to the security service, MI5. They weren't aware that visit took place. And
I mean, one does wonder what MI5 get up to, and they seem to know so little about somebody like this. Martin, the other thing here is they're now saying that he was the bomb maker, although in the beginning, certainly for the first few months, there was no idea that he had any kind of bomb making skills whatsoever and that someone else must have been involved. But this is all very convenient because the person who's now supposed to have been the bomb maker, making a bomb within just a couple of days of coming into the UK and exploding it, is dead.
Well, indeed. And, of course, it just raises more questions than answers, does it not? I would suggest that a bomb like that is unlikely to have been made by an individual. It's quite likely that there's a group involved. But if there's a group involved, then the explanation that we've been given about what happened doesn't stack up. And I come back to what I was saying earlier. My suspicion is that behind not just this attack, but the 7/7 attack and certainly the 9/11 attack and many other of these attacks, they're being orchestrated from within the Western intelligence services. And I know some people may be shocked to hear that, but they shouldn't be, because the reality is that's what's been going on for over 50 years.
Martin, it was also Parsons Green attack. That was the last year too. The MI5 only delivered all their papers that the Intelligence and Security Committee had been wanting yesterday. So the same day as they were supposed to be, these MPs were supposed to be telling us all about what happened on the Parsons Green attack, that's when this massive box of paperwork arrived from MI5. It doesn't sound as if they're actually cooperating with the Members of Parliament.
No, and you could argue, I mean, on one level it sounds as if they're trying to cover up the fact that they're incompetent and they didn't catch people and so on and so forth. But I think it's more sinister than that, frankly. If you know the history of their relationship with Al-Qaeda, with the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya and others, and what's been going on in Syria over the last 5 or 6 years, where it's absolutely clear that British Special Forces have been cooperating with Islamist terrorists to carry out bomb attacks of various kinds. And that's what we pay our taxes for. for, folks. Don't kid yourself. That's the real world.
Well, let's try and dig into a bit more behind this screen that's put up by the Intelligence and Security Committee, basically saying things like, well, they've got MI5 who had bigger fish to fry than Salman Abedi, even though he was about to blow up this bomb, and allegedly, anyway, possibly just be the patsy for someone else that did it, and that his father was working for MI6. So let's have a listen now to Alex Thompson, who's a former GCHQ officer. We had him on this programme, gosh, must be 4 or 5 months ago now, with quite a fascinating look at the privatisation of GCHQ and the intelligence services. And here he's talking to us about intelligence whistleblowers and what they tell us about what's really going on behind the scenes, that the Intelligence and Security Committee MPs have not managed to get any information from MI5 and the rest of them about at all.
Spycatcher by Peter Wright, I'm sure you know all the hoo-ha about that. It was published in the US. He went to live in Australia. He was the number two of MI5. He came up through the scientific route. He was not a public schoolboy. And he could see some things clearer than the old boys' tie network. But he couldn't quite conceive of the City of London and secular Zionism being the thievery, the heart of thievery involved. So there's a key point on page 317 where the absolute A1 Soviet defector, Anatoly Golitsyn, who tells us all about the long-range planning for the Soviets to survive the collapse of their territorial empire and to go into the West in the minds of men, Golitsyn has revealed all this, and Wright, who's number two at MI5, has the privilege of debriefing him and seeing him in person and waving photos in front of him and saying, "Do you remember this guy?" He leaves him, after much internal debate, with MI5's files on who might have been the MI5 mole, who was giving stuff away to the Soviets. And Golitsyn thinks and thinks. And then he comes back and says, "Your spies, Mr. Wright, are here. My methodology has uncovered them," he intoned darkly, pointing his finger like the witch finder at two files on the table in front of him. "I knew the files well. They belong to Victor Rothschild and Tess Rothschild." "Don't be totally absurd, Anatole," I said. "Victor is one of the best friends MI5 has ever had. How on earth did you jump to that conclusion?" He's not prepared to accept what Golitsyn, the best ever defector, is telling us. This one's in German, Die Deutsche Karte, which means playing the German card, written by a chap who died earlier this year, Hans-Gerd Kormoser, who was head of German military intelligence in the late Cold War. And the key point for him, I won't read this out, it's in German, but the key point is he's got a paragraph about Sir Stuart Mingus, the wartime head of MI6, and he's got an anecdote I've never found in English, which is that during the war, King George VI calls him over and says, "Mingus, what would happen if I were to ask you the name of our man in Berlin?" Mingus answered, "I would have to tell you, sire, that my lips are sealed." "Very good, Mingus. And imagine that I then followed that up by saying, 'Off with his head.' In that case, Your Majesty, my head would roll with my lips still sealed." So this is treason, okay? This is a bunch of people who've taken over under the sovereign, who are saying to the sovereign, "Stuff you don't get read into our intelligence world. It's not there for you, it's for a corporate group." Okay? So the evidence has been there through the decades by these intelligence whistleblowers that there has been an internal cabal which is vaguely overlapping with Britain and America, Israel and South Africa, but which is not in the service of the national interest or the people or the parliaments of any of those nations. There's no oversight of it. And they have formed, basically, an intelligence-sucking mass which is going to be put at the service of the emerging, supposedly EU, but really global corporate shock troops.
So that's Alex Thompson. He's a columnist and a regular appearance on something called the UK Column, run by Brian Gerrish, I think out of Plymouth. But Martin, what he's saying there is that actually the intelligence services have arranged themselves so nicely that actually they're far, far closer to the City of London. And he mentioned Tess Rothschild and Victor Rothschild there, far closer to the City of London than they are to any kind of scrutiny by the royals or by our MPs.
Well, of course. I mean, it strikes me as, why is anybody surprised by this? What do you imagine goes on in the real world? In the real world, powerful oligarchs suborn the institutions of the state to do what they want to do. They've been doing it for years. They're still doing it. And the idea that somehow these organisations are there to serve the people or even to serve the Queen is laughable. They're just not there for that. That's not what they're about. The Hambros Bank in the City of London was packed with ex-MI6 people. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which collapsed in the 90s, I think it was, CIA front organisation all the way. The Nugent Hand Bank in Australia, basically a intelligence service bank. So the intelligence services and the bankers are the same people. It's a revolving door, and that's what they do. They revolve.
So what's the point in having an intelligence and security committee then?
For show, Tony. For show. The pretense that something is actually a constitutional structure, I mean, under some kind of constitutional control, when in actual fact it isn't anything of the kind.
7-7, 50 people dying, 22 people in Manchester. How many innocent British people have to die before we get some changes and any kind of proper scrutiny of the intelligence and services? I mean, we're talking particularly here about MI5, who is actually their job to stop this kind of thing.
Well, ultimately, all of these organisations...
Can they be taken to court?
All of these organisations will ultimately have to be disbanded.
Martin, Robbie Potter wants to take them to court. Is that feasible?
I can see why he's saying that, but that might be one line of attack to chip away at them, if you see what I mean.
They always appear behind screens, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, Colonel Jay appeared behind a screen in Northern Ireland. It turned out in the end that he was Brigadier Gordon Kerr, and he was in fact running the UDA's Chief Intelligence Officer Brian Nelson as one of his agents, and therefore orchestrating the UDA's terror campaign, which killed hundreds of people. But has he been punished? No, he hasn't. There was a panorama programme by John Ware about him, and he was doorstepped in Beijing, but no doubt he's living somewhere high on the hog as a pensioner of the British state, even though it's pretty clear that he's a terrorist.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
News just yesterday, Martin. We've got that this chap who's called... what is his name? Matthew Hedges. He's actually a young lad from Durham University. He's just been given life in prison in the UAE.
Yes, well, what's going on there, one may well ask. And one may well ask, why have we got a relationship with the UAE anyway? What sort of democratic votes do they have in the UAE? Oh, they don't have any. In actual fact, the UAE is a created state created by MI6 back in the 1920s. They created all of these nations,
Hang on, in the 20s and 30s and 40s, up until the 1950s, actually, that was all Oman, that part of the Gulf.
Well, Oman still exists, of course, but all of these Gulf states...
Bahrain has been created.
All of these Gulf states are basically creations of MI6. They didn't exist before MI6 created them.
Anyway,
and then we talk about having a relationship with them as if they're a foreign country. And they are a foreign country in a way, but they're basically our own creation.
So let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions where this whole matter came up.
Crispin Blunt!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Durham University PhD student Matthew Hedges was arrested when he was leaving the UAE, having completed his research into the impact of the Arab Spring on the UAE's foreign policy. He has now been sentenced to life imprisonment for spying for the United Kingdom. A number of us will note the irony of a former MI6 officer who works in the outer office of the ruler, of the de facto ruler of the UAE, who has organised many of the excellent visits from this house to the UAE. But this is wholly inconsistent with the behaviour of a nation with whom we have a mutual defence accord. Will the Prime Minister please give this her urgent attention? And if he's not released, I don't see why we should be committed to their defence.
I say to my honourable friend, we are, of course, as he is, deeply disappointed and concerned at today's verdict, and I realise how difficult and distressing this is, both for Matthew Hedges but also for his family. We are raising it with the Emirati authorities at the highest level. My right honourable friend, the Foreign Secretary, is urgently seeking a call with the Foreign Minister, Abdullah bin Zayed. During his visit to the UAE on November the 12th, he raised the issue with both Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed and the Foreign Minister, and I can assure my honourable friend and other members that the Foreign Office will remain in close contact with Matthew, his family and his lawyer. We will continue to do all we can to support them as they consider the next steps, and we will continue to press this matter at the highest level with the Emiratis.
does seem a little bit cheeky for MI6 to send a college kid out there. Can't they actually have someone who's got a little bit of experience if they want to have a spy? One of the things that frustrates me about this whole thing, Martin, is that it's assumed, of course, totally without any kind of balance from the other side, that this guy was perfectly innocent. I mean, all of our media reports on it.
Well, I wouldn't like to judge that. He may be a genuinely independent who's basically been caught up because the UAE don't like his sticking his finger into their business. But of course, the UAE, along with Britain and Saudi Arabia, are involved with the massive tragedy in Yemen, where thousands and thousands of people, mostly civilians, are starving to death. They've got cholera. There's a continuous rain of bombs, many of which are built here in Bristol. And we're really worried about this poor old PhD student. It's like the lady in Iran, who Boris Johnson infelicitously said was over there to train journalists, even though she was actually supposedly over there on a holiday. Now, it's quite possible that these people wandering around the place are working for our intelligence services, or they might just be random people caught up in the mess. But the reality is, MI6 works very closely with all of these.
Now, the suggestion here seems to be that Britain is falling out of favour internationally, and that many of these countries, like the UAE, are saying, well, let's grab a few, bag ourselves a few people who we think or know or suspect are working for the British security services and keep them as bargaining chips.
Well, I mean, as you pointed out earlier...
Why would they want to do that?
Well, why would they want to do that when they've got somebody seconded from MI6 working at the top of their security structure?
I think he's a former...
Former, yes. Are there any such... Is there such a thing as a former MI6 officer? Khashoggi was basically a CIA man, which is why there's been such a lot of fuss about him being murdered in such a horrible way in Turkey.
I suppose what I'm implying here is that actually global tensions are gradually ramping up, and that countries are not trusting Britain or other countries as much as they used to, and that these actually do enable some sort of quid pro quo. So they'll say, the UAE will say, well, we want this off of you, and we'll release this guy if you give it to us.
Quite possibly. That's more than likely what's going on here. But people, if we're going to talk about the UAE, we've got to talk about the UAE's intervention in Yemen. Now, when countries invade other countries, like Soviet Union invading Czechoslovakia, or Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, or when Serbia, God forbid, tried to keep Kosovo as part of Serbia, we went to war. But now the UAE and Saudi Arabia have invaded Yemen, and not only are we not going to war with Saudi Arabia, we're supporting the aggression, which is killing thousands and thousands of people. At what point is there blowback for behaving like that? And of course, it's not just a question of blowback. Maybe we're orchestrating the whole thing.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Why don't we, I think, move now to have a little look at Israel? Because obviously in the Middle East, that's one of the major problems. There's tension building between them and the Iranians. And I picked up this clip from Miko Peled, who I believe his father was actually a general in the Israeli army. And Miko also served in the Israeli army, but he has become someone who's very outspoken. In fact, he goes around the world speaking, and mm-hmm. he's done several books about what he believes is the Israeli genocide and racism towards the Palestinians. And he starts here by talking about the way that there's a brainwashing goes on within Israel of young Israeli children in schools.
There's an education system, the Zionist education system, like Judith alluded, my sister just wrote a book about it, she's an educator, that teaches racism in a very subtle way. There's a bureaucracy, an entire bureaucracy, that is dedicated to making life impossible for Palestinians through all kinds of restrictions and permits and requirements that are absolutely uncalled for and unnecessary, but are all given and provided under the guise of security. And then you've got the Israeli army, which I like to refer to as one of the best trained, best equipped, best fed terrorist organizations in the world. And yes, they have generals and they have nice uniforms, but their entire purpose is terrorism. And just as one example, I'll give you one example. Almost exactly 4 years ago, as Israel began its attack on Gaza, September the 27th, 2008, at 11:25 in the morning. What I refer to as the most shameful day in the Jewish history. The most shameful day in the history of the Jewish people. Israel began carpet bombing Gaza, and on the first day of what was to be a 21-day attack, they dropped 100 tons of bombs. Okay, a one-ton bomb will decimate an entire city block. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places in the world. 800,000 children live in Gaza. 11:25 is exactly the time when the morning school shift and the afternoon school shift change. So all the kids are in the streets. All the children are on the streets. That was the moment decided by the decision makers in Israel to begin the attack. This was the first day of a 21-day slaughter that had absolutely no justification. If that's not terrorism, I don't know what is. And this is how the state of Israel manages to control the different populations and somehow still keep up this very sweet liberal kind of face to everything. But we still have to figure out how we go from here. Well, let's look at what happened in South Africa. They got rid of apartheid. That is the example. What did they do in America? They got rid of the racist laws that existed in the South. Did the whites in South Africa want this, like this? Absolutely not. Did the whites in the southern states in America, here in the United States, want this or like this? No. It was not done by consensus. But Zionism, just like racism, has to go. The Zionist state has to be replaced with a democracy. Equal rights. We have 5.5 million Palestinians, about 6.5 million Israelis. There's absolutely no reason in the world why they can't live together as equals.
Well, that's Miko Peled there, whose father was a general. He himself served in the Israeli forces, and he's now disgusted. He calls the IDF one of the most powerful terrorist forces in the world, certainly the most powerful in the Middle East.
Well, not just, I mean, obviously he's talking about, the attacks on Gaza by aeroplanes or whatever, but also Mossad are heavily involved in the kind of false flag terrorism we were talking about earlier. For example, cooperating with terrorist groups inside Syria, just as our own intelligence services do. And don't forget the Israeli state was founded by terrorists. The Irgun, the Haganah, they were terrorists. They blew things up, they killed people, and they got the state they wanted, and that's how that state was created.
Well, while we're talking about Israel, Tommy Robinson, and I say that because it's actually a pro-Israel think tank that funds Tommy Robinson's legal costs, mm-hmm. Has been appointed as UKIP's grooming gang's advisor. Leader Gerald Batten gives his role to anti-Islam activists, shifting the party towards the far right. He's not actually allowed to join UKIP because Tommy Robinson is part of, whether it's the EDL or whatever it is part of an organisation that UKIP have banned. No one is allowed from those organisations to join UKIP, but he is allowed to be appointed as UKIP's grooming gang advisor. And now this was against the wishes of the National Executive, because he's a direct advisor to Gerald Batten. The National Executive of UKIP were about to vote overwhelmingly to block Tommy Robinson, but Gerald Batten has decided he's not interested in that. Now, talking to some of the UKIP people, Martin, it looks like they may well split over this, but certainly it's paralysed it at the time of Brexit. And also Nigel Farage has condemned Gerald Batten for taking Tommy Robinson on.
Well, Tommy Robinson, of course, if you remember, he left the EDL and then he claimed that he was working with the Quilliam Foundation, who are supposedly moderate Muslims. And do you know what I think all of this is? I think all of it is shadow play by the intelligence services. They're creating Islamist terrorism, they're creating far-right terrorism, and they're creating all of the conflicts in society which then justify the police state that they really want to have and where we're probably going to end up unless we wake up.
UK church has boycotted companies profiting from Israel's occupation of Palestine. You don't often hear much about the Quakers, but the Quakers, I confess my interest, I'm a Quaker, boycotted any companies that are making money out of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, Martin. That's just this.
Well, it's a straw in the wind. What the Israeli government is...
It's the first British church to do it, though.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's probably the first of many. The Israelis now basically are facing the potential for an international boycott I mean, if we're going to have sanctions on Russia and sanctions on Serbia and sanctions on goodness knows who, there's absolutely no reason why we can't have sanctions on Israel. It's a subsidy state. It survives only because US taxpayers chuck loads of money at it. If they all had to work for a living, they'd soon find that they'd change their attitude.
Also, the Israeli envoy's appearance at a London university has been shelved over security concerns. That's Mark Regev, who was going to be talking at City University in London yesterday night. Was shelved. That's just earlier this week. I think that was probably Wednesday night he was supposed to be speaking there, but he couldn't go because he thought that he might be attacked, I guess. Israel is going to take Airbnb to court because Airbnb has excluded West Bank settlements from its website. That's on Tuesday, Martin.
Well, that's, and again, a straw in the wind. And, of course, ultimately, there's a very hard line, just about majority amongst Jews in Israel, for taking a very hard line on everything and expanding their territory and all the rest of it. And the only answer to that, as the guy said earlier, is it's not necessarily going to be consensual. We're going to cut off your aid, we're going to cut off your trade, we're going to cut off all military supplies, and if you want to carry on being a garrison state, you're going to starve.
Also, Israel is the most dangerous country in the Middle East. This is actually the former Dutch Prime Minister saying this. This is around about this time last year. The former Prime Minister's name is Dries van Agt, and he says that they have a range of nuclear bombs and the most dangerous country in the Middle East by far.
Well, a defence intellectual, Martin von Krevelt, in Israel, years ago said, what the Europeans have got to understand is that we can deliver a nuclear bomb on Berlin, Rome, Paris, or wherever. So that if you're talking about people threatening us, that's who's threatening
us. That's MiddleEastMonitor.com, also saying this week, saying that the tide is turning. Israel is losing on two war fronts. The botched Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip on the 12th of November is delineating Tel Aviv's failure to utilise its army as a tool to achieve Palestinian political concessions. Now that the Palestinian popular resistance has gone global through the exponential rise and growing success of boycott, divestment and sanctions, the Israeli government is fighting two desperate wars and losing them both.
And they're also losing in Syria, where the deployment of the SS-300s to the Syrian Arab Army means that they've been unable to carry out any airstrikes whatsoever since they shot down the Russian plane.
Well, they're saying
that
any S-300s that shoot down Israeli planes in Israeli airspace, those S-300s will be taken out by the Israelis.
Well, except that they haven't dared to risk it. Because let's see, it's going to be testing Russian kit against Israeli kit. And don't forget, the Russians are quite a long way away. The Israelis are going to take the casualties, isn't it?
Going on now to look at Julian Assange. We did talk last week a bit about Michael Hastings, the journalist who was investigating John Brennan, the head of the CIA, when his car mysteriously accelerated up to 85 miles an hour and swerved into a tree, even though he has his foot on the brakes. He was working for Rolling Stone magazine, and he'd written books as well. Michael Hastings, almost certainly, it looks like, killed in a hacked car attack. But also there's a guy called Danny Jawenko, Martin. Do you want to tell us a bit about him? He died in a very mysterious car crash.
No.
He was a Dutch controlled demolition expert.
Ah, yes, I'm trying to remember who he was, yeah. Well, I mean, given all the things we've been saying about the Western intelligence services in this programme, do you think that they would stoop to killing individual people who got in the way? We're just talking about them killing innocent people in Manchester, orchestrating things in the Middle East. Are they prepared to kill individuals by hacking their cars?
There was a guy called...
Is the Pope a Catholic?
Somebody called MK also mysteriously died in a strange car accident. Do you know who he was? MK was Vladimir Putin's driver.
Oh, indeed, yes, that's right. And he just swerved onto the other side of the motorway in Moscow and crashed the car, as a professional driver.
On the Kotovsky Avenue, his car just swerved mysteriously, magnetised into the opposite carriageway. With Julian Assange, his lawyer is warning that US charges against him endanger press freedom worldwide, Martin. This is in Democracy Now. Mm-hmm. But the US is charging Assange, and it looks as if they want to bang him up, actually, doesn't it?
Well, some people in the US have called for him either to be assassinated or executed, so it's not just a question of banging him up, is it? The evil of these people and the lengths they're prepared to go to should be obvious by now to all but the purblind. Western intelligence services are way, way out of control. And we were talking earlier about what needs to be done about them. I would suggest that what needs to be done about them is pretty much what happened to the KGB after the fall of the Soviet Union. They've got to be completely dismantled and rebuilt from scratch. Same with the police service of Northern Ireland and the RUC or the armed forces in South Africa. You've just got to basically sack everybody, and some people get their jobs back, but most people won't.
It looks as if Ecuador is pretty much jettisoning Assange, even though he's still there. They're not helping him anymore. They say he must sort out his own issues with Britain and America.
Well, that's because the Ecuadorians are themselves under heavy manners from the Americans. Rafael Correa, who was the former president of Ecuador, he's had to leave Ecuador now because he's fallen out with Lenin Moreno, who's his successor. But Lenin Moreno has turned out to be a puppet of the Americans. So Correa, who used to be the president, of course, he couldn't stand for more than two terms. He's had to leave the country because he can't live under Moreno's regime. And Moreno has moved Ecuador back into the pro-US camp in Latin America because there's basically a counter-revolution going on across Latin America where through coup d'etat of various kinds, the far right are coming back to power as they always were in the 1980s and into the 1990s. So at that point, Assange has bet on the wrong embassy to be in. He might have been better off in the Cuban embassy, eh?
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
I suppose we really ought to do this is looking at some of the manoeuvrings behind the scenes, potentially anyway, the people that are really controlling things, because we certainly don't seem to be getting much use from people like the Intelligence and Security Committee and the Prime Minister. And this is a chap called Joseph Wages. He's a Freemason himself, but he believes that there are Freemasons out there and people involved with Freemasonry, and not necessarily just that, other cults as well, because Freemasonry is a religious cult, who deliberately attempt to infiltrate politics and then to control things from behind the scenes. So let's see what Joseph Wages has to say.
In the actual Minerval degree, Illuminatus minor degree, Scottish novice, Scottish knight, the oaths that they're really swearing is that they're going to maintain inviolable secrecy. So the only ones that have like the so-called death penalty are the ones in the Masonic degrees itself. But those aren't unique to the Illuminati. They're kind of patterned off of Freemasonry. So if we look at it from a larger perspective, they're using Freemasonry as a vehicle for expansion. So the Illuminati's like subversion is less to do with civil society and more to do with Freemasonry. But I'm not saying that there's not a push towards global governance. You'd be a fool to say the opposite of that. And the ultimate idea is to impact and change the world for the better. So they're not advocating for the violent overthrow of governments per se, but what they're advocating for is the influence of government. So one of the things they say several times in the rituals is that, you can overthrow a government and you'll get no change for the better, and more than likely than not, the change for the worse. So the idea is for the heads of state, whether they be dukes or kings or princes or so forth, is to surround them with advisors educated in their system to prevent these people from making the wrong decisions or doing things that are not in the interest of the society and are maybe motivated by their own interest.
Well, there's a certain amount of sense in that, Martin, isn't there? Because if you have a revolution, you really don't know who's going to come out on top. Anybody could.
Well, I mean, and there's different kinds of meaning of the word revolution as well. I mean, change is obviously always going to be problematic when you've got powerful groups who want to steer everything in their own interests.
Anyway, there's a chap called David Livingstone. We had a clip from him a few weeks ago. He's got a new book coming out soon called Ordo Ab Chao, means order from chaos. And he's also a big believer, as I am, in the potential, anyway, for secret societies to be running things from behind the scenes. And this latest book is, as he's a convert to Islam, and he sees the Islam as the main target of these groups.
What they're trying to do is fulfill the Book of Revelation, right? So they, you and I, or most people would read it and see the predictions as terrible things to happen. But since these guys are Luciferians, they see it backwards. So that's why it's a blueprint. So they believe that they need to fulfill the chaos that is prophesied in the Book of Revelation in order to accelerate the coming of the Messiah. And this is stated almost verbatim, or explicitly, by Alexander Dugin, who is really the architect of the Russian influence campaign in the United States. And he basically says exactly that, that the Book of Revelation is not, he said that it's a task. It's a responsibility. And so they don't see, you know, creating wars and destruction, famine, disease as a problem. They see it as a requirement, that it's all part of the necessary stages that have to happen to bring about the coming of the Messiah. Their Messiah, so it's the Antichrist.
So, I mean, is it potential, Martin, that even though these things are sort of prophesied in the Book of Revelation, that people are looking at that book and saying, actually, that would be good, let's make this happen?
Well, there are people out there who take the Book of Revelation literally and are trying to implement it. I mean, the Christian Zionists in the US believe that they support Israel because they believe that there's going to be a final war, and then the Jews are going to convert to Christianity and the Messiah will come.
But those people are not
the generals in charge of the fighting.
They see that as a good thing. It's incredible.
Indeed they do, because that's the kind of thinking that you get when you believe in prophecy from books written in the Bronze
and
Age.
You would have thought that they wouldn't be actually trying to make this happen, surely.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that they do want to make it happen, but whether they would explain why
they don't want to negotiate with Iran, for example.
Well, indeed, because in actual fact they want a conflict. But whether they're the ones who are actually calling the shots is another matter. I think the people calling the shots are cynical, self-centred oligarchs, and they want what they want, and they use all this other stuff as a load of flim-flam to keep the masses where they want them.
Okay, finally tonight, let's have a listen to William Stewart, who we heard a couple of weeks ago, and his thoughts on the creation of Zionism. He believes it goes back to 1881.
So there you've got, you know, something quite significant in 1881. You've got the war-making groups returning to Britain and then moving and strengthening their position in America. 1881, a new and very virulent form of Red Templar masonry was created, used to hide all the goings-on, and it was called the Ancient and Primitive Rite. Now, this was circulated in the Middle East, so we know that a war-making rite was added to all the other things that we've had in the Middle East since 1710, and the creation of the Muslim Brotherhood. So obviously the Muslim Brotherhood that is affected by this catches hold of the Ancient and Primitive Rite.
So the three groups that we know about, the Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderbergs, and the Trilateral Commission, you're saying is actually linked to a splinter group of the CIA?
Yes, I mean, as you know, CIA does good work for America. There are lots of great patriots in it. They did some very good work. Some of them did some very good work around the time of 9/11, but unfortunately some of them did not. And what the Lombards do is they take our main institutions, including intelligence units, and they split them so that you've got what you know about and then something hidden underneath. The Fabians was a very good example of this. For instance, it had utopian left wing on the outside, which founded the Labour Party. Inside, it was run by the most extreme radical, rancid bankers, the Society of the Elect. So you get the idea. And yes, there is a link between the splinter that they've created of the CIA and Rockefeller's relative who created the CIA, and then the Rockefeller groups, which are, as you say, Council of Foreign Relations, Bilderberg and Triatric Commission.
Well, I'll let you get back to 1881. What else was significant?
Right, in 1881 too, so it was going on in 1882, begun in 1881, Baron Edmund Rothschild was working with what are called radical Zionists. Now, these are people who outwardly want the state of Israel to exist and to be reasonably right-wing. But Zionism itself can be traced back into the young movement of the Lombards. So really speaking, 1881, Baron Edmund Rothschild met with Lombard planning for right-wing activity in the Middle East to try to set up, if you like, a young Israel or a right-wing Israel state. He contacted Rabbi Samuel, and I'll call him Rabbi Samuel because I can't even begin to pronounce the second name, but he's Rabbi Samuel. Rabbi Samuel was expecting Armageddon. That's the Seventh War, a final battle of Armageddon to take place, after which a new nation, Israel, would arise and conquer all the areas around it as found in the Old Testament. And I have to ask you what Mr. Rothschild banker was doing, organising such a in such a volatile region with people who actually wanted Armageddon. Now, I put in the book there are other rabbis and so forth on the same tack. But, of course, we are dealing with a radical organisation which is banker-based. It is nothing to do with the State of Israel. And those are perfectly genuine, good, nice people in Israel who have nothing to do with this. Now, we have to return a little bit and try to fit these things together. In 1881, Western bankers began to take control of the Ottoman Empire. And don't forget, it's the Ottoman Empire that the breakup of it by the Muslim Brotherhood, owned by our bankers, that caused World War I. Then the war-making round table, which we've talked very briefly about, which was the Lombards coming back to Britain and going to America, having been kicked out of Britain. They were fresh from causing the Boer War and the Russian Revolution a bit later on. They took charge of the process of creating the State of Israel at the Paris Peace Conference of 2nd of November 1919. And it was called the Balfour Declaration, after somebody who was sort of attached, as it were, to the British government. But unfortunately, the bankers were using the Milner Round Table, the one that did the Boer War and later the Russian Revolution and so on, to create the State of Israel. And this truth did not come out until the 21st of July 1936. As released by parliamentarian Ormsby Gore. So you tell me what the war makers were doing setting up a State of Israel that wanted and expected Armageddon being founded by the most profound war makers on earth.
That was William Stewart, his book The Secret College, 9/11 to Armageddon. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page at thisweek.org. UK. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to hear excerpts from our recent Media Freedom Summit 2.0, Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice, our biannual summit held this year at College of Marin, north of San Francisco. We'll hear discussions of how corporate media overlook or stereotype working class Americans, especially working class women. Later in the program, we'll learn about a long-running but rarely reported story, the occupation of Kashmir. Stay with us today on the Project Censored Show for excerpts from our Media Freedom Summit 2.0.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In October this year, Project Censored presented the second Media Freedom Summit, Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice. Held at the College of Marin, just north of San Francisco, the event featured workshops on a wide range of media issues. On today's Project Censored Show, we'll hear excerpts from two of those workshops. Later in the program, we'll hear about India's occupation of Kashmir from a journalist who grew up under that occupation. But we begin the program with a discussion of how U.S. media either overlook or stereotype working-class Americans. The first speaker for this panel was Dr. Steve Masick. He's professor of communications and media studies at North Central College outside of Chicago. He's also part of the Union for Democratic Communications. He'll be followed by Dr. Robin Anderson, professor of communications and media studies at Fordham University in New York, also part of the Union for Democratic Communications.
What are the defining characteristics of a member of the working class?
somebody who lives paycheck to paycheck, doesn't have substantial family wealth or savings to fall back on. They're the backbone of everything getting done. So how did you, I think that's a really succinct way of defining who the working class is. So I want to spend just a second talking about who is, according to sociologists and economists who study class, what the academic literature says about who is working class. So one of the classic studies of the working class in the United States is Michael Spike's The Working Class Majority. It's a bit dated since it came out in the year 2000, but he defined people as working class who are in occupations where they don't have substantial control over the content of their work, right? They're not managers. So he's using a kind of classic sociological definition of the working class as people who are taking directions from other people, don't have control over what they do on a daily basis. And he looked at all the various different occupational categories that the Department of Labor gathers statistics on, and he concluded that 62% of the U.S. workforce is working class, and 38% are middle class and above. And what he defined middle class as is people who have some degree of say in what they do on a daily basis, who get to choose the tasks that they work on and so on, meaning that they're either middle class or upper class. And a very small minority of that group, roughly 2 to 3%, are in the capitalist class. And the capitalists are people who are not compelled to work, to earn a wage, right? They can survive on the wealth that they have and on investment income. That's 2 to 3% of the 38%. Yeah. So 2 to 3% of that 38% are rentiers. They have enough investment income that they can live solely off of investment income. They don't need to work in order to live. But there is actually a debate about class because other analysts have given varying estimates of the size of the American working class. One problem with Spike's analysis is that by focusing on labor force participation, he leaves out the unemployed, the disabled, those working in the informal economy. And Marxists, who have a different definition of class, who define class in terms of your relationship to the means of production, right, whether or not you have control over the means of production or not, Marxists like the sociologist Eric Olin Wright would put the size of the working class as much higher, you know, in the neighborhood of 80% of the population, according to his analysis, would be working class. Other commentators define class as a function of both education and occupation. So one recent analysis defined U.S. working class as participants in the labor force with less than a four-year college degree. It seems like a somewhat arbitrary definition of class, but nevertheless, still, according to that analysis, the working class is the plurality of the population. 43% of U.S. adults are working class. And the most important thing, I think, to note about the working class in contemporary America is their economic position in terms of annual wages, things like benefits, is continuing to worsen and has been worsening for something like four decades, right? And in fact, even during this economic boom that we're living through right now that Trump loves to brag about, really what's happened is wages have kind of plateaued and they've inched up by tiny, tiny amounts, average wages. But the Pew Research Center did an analysis where they concluded that now less than half of adults are middle class, and they define middle class income as at least two-thirds of the U.S. median household income, which is like in the neighborhood of $50,000 a year. I wouldn't agree with their definition of middle class, but what the chart shows you is that people's relative economic position is worsening. One thing, though, that all of the commentators on class agree on is that women, people of color, and LGBTQ people are much more likely to be working class than white men. And that's ironic given that the standard image, right, of the working class is the kind of reactionary Archie Bunker, Ralph Cramden, Al Bundy, white working class male who works in a factory job. Women now make up nearly half of the working class, 36%, according to one estimate, even though only 50% of women work in paid employment outside the home. So the overall workplace participation rate is 63%. So women who work are disproportionately working class. People of color are overrepresented in the American working class. African Americans are 12.7% of the U.S. population overall, but make up 14% of the working class. Latinx make up 17.8% of the population overall, but are 20% of the working class. Lesbians and transgender people are much more likely to be poor and much more likely to come from poor and working class families than are gay men or straight people. So one figure that researchers came up with is that 24% of lesbians and bisexuals are poor as compared to 19% of heterosexual women. And of course, we know that in America, poverty is feminized, and so women are overrepresented in the ranks of the poor. Transgender individuals are four times more likely to have household incomes below 10% and twice as likely to be unemployed as the average U.S. adult. So if you look at the factual, social scientific analysis of the American working class, what it tells you is that the working class is overwhelmingly women, disproportionately of color, disproportionately LGBTQ, and yet that is absolutely not the image that we get when we look at the mainstream mass media. And I'm going to try to keep this very short so Robin can come up and talk. But I think no matter what kind of media we're talking about, whether we're talking about scripted entertainment media like Hollywood films and television shows, or we're looking at news media, right, news coverage, I think what we find is an endless repetition of a series of very derogatory stereotypes that perform, I think, a very powerful ideological function in legitimating class inequality and economic inequality in American society. One thing that analysts, people who do media studies like myself, have noted is the way that television programming, entertainment television programming, endlessly reproduces the image of the white working class male buffoon, right, who is portrayed as stupid, as unambitious, as politically reactionary, and as bigoted. And this started like years and years ago with the Honeymooners and has been a constant recurring image in television shows ever since, up to the current day with people like Peter Griffin on Family Guy. So a guy by the name of Richard Butch did an analysis of over 260 sitcoms from the late 1940s, actually, which is when, you know, network television really started to get going, up through the mid-1990s. And what he found in that, first of all, is that the working class was virtually invisible, right? Only 11% of the characters on the sitcoms were working class. The sitcoms overrepresented upper class characters. There are lots of lawyers and architects on the sitcoms, heading households on the sitcoms. And that when there were working class characters, that they tended to conform to this stereotypical image of the white working class male buffoon. There are very few working class characters who are people of color. And he didn't even talk about the question of sexual orientation in there or sexual identity in the study. But it's a very striking study. And it's a pretty horrible show called Family Guy. And it's essentially an animated version, of The Honeymooners and All in the Family. So Peter Griffin in this show is like the embodiment of everything that Richard Butch talks about in his classic study of the way the media endlessly reproduces the white working class buffoon. He's lazy, he's unambitious, he's stupid, he is dumb as a post. And he's really to blame, right, for the fact that he gets fired. I mean, I think, and it's that last piece that's really important here, because I think we have to ask ourselves, what ideological function does the endlessly reproduced image of the stupid, unambitious, culturally conservative, reactionary working class male serve? The function that it serves is to explain the existence of inequality. So if wages have been going down for ordinary workers for three decades, that's not the company's fault. That's not the fault of wealthy capitalists trying to accumulate more profits and more wealth for themselves. It's the fault of the defective members of the working class. Similarly, one study has found that in the average lifespan, the average worker will fall into poverty under the official poverty line. 40%, right, of the working class will fall under that official poverty line at some point in their lives. And if that's the case, if members of the working class all of a sudden become poor, it's not because they're in an economy that's rigged and the deck is stacked against them and their unions have disappeared and their political power has disappeared and they have no power in which to enforce policies or contracts that would, you know, increase their wages or give them more economic security. No, it's because they're stupid idiots like Peter Griffin. It would be one thing if it was just scripted television shows, and Butch has a very interesting theory about why TV writers and producers and directors of TV shows love this image of the white working class male buffoon and keep endlessly reproducing it. But in the interest of time, I kind of want to move forward and note that this same kind of image permeates, I would argue, news media coverage of class in American society and class issues. Now, the first thing I think that needs to be said, and I think it's pretty obvious, and actually the Project Censored Top 25 stories draw attention to this every year, is that the working class is usually invisible in the American news media. The American news media is much more interested in the daily gyrations of the stock market, which really only matter to the wealthiest of the wealthy. Well, it may be the case that many people in this room, maybe half of the people in this room, have retirement accounts that are invested in the stock market. The fact of the matter is we don't actively manage those accounts. The people who actively manage stock accounts are the 1%, what the Occupy movement called the 1%, the people who control the vast majority of the wealth, the people that Peter Phillips writes about in his book, Giant, the global financial elite. They're the ones who are actively managing the economy. And the media is endlessly interested in what's happening with the stock market. But we don't get a daily report about unemployment. We don't get daily reports about the number of people who are injured and become disabled, right, on the job, even though the Department of Labor gathers information about that as well. They have those statistics. It's not like they're difficult to get. So the working class is usually invisible in the news media with two real exceptions, I think. First of all, anytime there is a strike. And so we know that in San Francisco right now, members of the HERE, the hotel and restaurant workers, are striking against a number of the Marriott hotels down there. And they have gotten some news coverage for that because they are being disruptive. They're picketing in front of the hotels. They're inconveniencing consumers. And I think it's interesting to note that the way that strikes are covered in the news media is almost always not from the worker's perspective, not from the perspective of the striking worker, but instead from the perspective of consumers who are inconvenienced by the labor action that unions are engaging in. And from what little I have seen about the coverage of the Marriott strike here in San Francisco, it's following that same pattern. And if anyone is interested, my friend Christopher Martin wrote a book called Framed, which looks at the way news media cover strikes, and he's found that this is a consistent pattern in coverage of things like the UPS strike and others. The other occasion in which labor and workers receive some attention in the news media is in connection with political campaigns, because every 4 years, news organizations descend, right, on the American heartland to try to find ordinary working class voters and get their perspective on the issues. But the way that they define members of the working class is identical to the way that scripted television shows define membership in the working class. They're only really interested in blue collar, white, and preferably reactionary workers who they then go talk to. It plays into what was the dominant news media narrative, which was the reason that Trump got elected is that he had the support of the working class, and specifically the white male blue-collar worker from states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and so on. And so essentially what the media is doing is blaming Trump's victory on the working class. And in a previous session, a woman who wrote a piece for the News Abuse chapter of this year's Project Censored book, talked about her extensive analysis of the way that the media were essentially spinning out this narrative that the working class is to blame for Trump's election. Despite the fact that if you define the working class the way I have here, that it's very clear that the vast majority of the working class did not vote for Trump. Moreover, the vast majority of the working class didn't vote. They engaged in electoral abstentionism, and so it's ridiculous to blame them, and it clearly perpetuates this kind of ideological myth about the working class being reactionary. The other thing that's interesting to note, just briefly, and then I'm going to hand it over to Robin, is that news coverage of non-white people of color, females, politically progressive voters in this last election often failed to identify them as members of the working class. So people who are clearly working class, right, in terms of their income level, in terms of their occupation, were not classified, were not labeled or named as working class by the news media if they were women or if they were people of color, which is a way of, to use the term that was introduced in the last session on news abuse, ex-nominating them, denying them an identity. And similarly, when the news media cover political movements that clearly have a class element, like Black Lives Matter or the Wildcat teachers' strikes that spread across West Virginia and Oklahoma, oftentimes those are not analyzed in terms of class and not understood in terms of class. And Robin, I'm going to hand it over to you.
No, I'd like to. This is the Project Censored Show. I am your host, Mickey Huff. We just heard part of a workshop for our recent Media Freedom Summit 2.0. It was Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice, held at the College of Marin, just north of San Francisco in October of this year. That was Steve Masick speaking about corporate media misrepresentation of working class Americans. Coming up, we're going to hear more from that workshop. The next speaker is Robin Anderson of Fordham University. She'll summarize how television has depicted working class women and also offer a class analysis of the Me Too movement. Stay with us.
I'm just going to quickly follow Steve's remarks with some exit polling I inserted into an article I wrote shortly after the election, just to kind of underscore the ways that poor and working class people were not primarily the ones that voted for Trump. So unemployment in the counties that they did vote for Trump was considerably up. Those making below $50,000, primarily voted for Clinton. And those are the poor working men and women of color that Steve was referring to. What they were into was they had listened, I think, very carefully to the Trump campaign. And 84% of Trump voters told pollsters that immigrants should be deported. And so in that sense, I guess we can say he's keeping his campaign promises. 86% of those people who voted for Trump were in favor of a border wall. And half of the Trump supporters believe that the Japanese internment camps in World War II were a good idea. And on Twitter, with his Pepe the Frog and all of the stuff that he was retweeting, which was, of course, far more effective, than, in my opinion, than what the Russians did, really a wonderful reporter, Luke O'Brien, did in-depth coverage of the alt-right. It came out just before the election, and he was hanging out with these guys, and they really did want an ethno-national state, ethno-European state. I just wanted to talk about that very briefly. I'm going to talk about television representations of women and the women's movement, and then I hope we can have a discussion of how we can merge the class and racial divide within the women's movement and move towards some progressive politics and see how we can deal with that now. I'm going to go back to some early television. Now, some of you may recognize these programs, and if you would like to talk about your impressions of them, feel free to interrupt me at any time. So most of the people on television, as Steve has very well pointed out, are professional technical. They're doctors, lawyers, and things like that. And they comprised historically almost 80% of television characters. Very few working class and very few single working class women. There are so few that the single working class women, a handful of programs, are constantly brought up when we're talking about the single working class women. And of course, it was Marla Thomas as that girl.
And she was an actress, but she didn't really have to work. She didn't want to. But her only alternative really was to get married. So those are the representations at that time that we had. Now, Julie was very unusually an interesting program. It went for 3 years, and she was terrifically glamorous. She was a nurse, but she was pretty middle class. She lived in a very fancy New York apartment. But it was very ahead of its time in terms of race. But it kind of denied the real problems with working class and working black women. And she was terrifically glamorous. The program that is heralded still today, and I'm sure many of us watched it and loved it. I mean, you got to love Mary. She was, you know, an executive at WJM Television in the Midwest. And they had to come up with a whole kind of Bible book about, well, how did you explain that somebody like Mary isn't married? You know, okay, so they messed with that. And following on Mary Tyler Moore, of course, Laverne and Shirley was one of the only programs that actually showed people on an assembly line, and they worked in a bottling factory. It was really mostly about their antics with who they were dating and their strong New York accents or strong accents of some sorts. Anyway, they were pretty beloved. They lasted for quite a while, but they were a rare occurrence of the working class before Roseanne. Now, arguably, the first Roseanne really did talk about issues of how money is constantly an issue in their lives, the kind of underlying economic and social deprivation of life in neoliberalism and the growing neoliberalism of the country at the time. And in that, Roseanne Barr did some very revolutionary television. Of course, we all know what happened with the reboot, which basically took political partisanship and turned it into caricature, with little jabbing jokes between Jackie and her sister, and the jokes invariably benefited Trump. So this is kind of what we've got in American representation for single women, single working women on television. And then most recently, we had Murphy Brown. Interestingly, Murphy Brown has been revived. Did anybody see the revival that took place? I didn't watch it. But she's supposed to be taking on Trump now, Murphy Brown. But these women were primarily, the single working women, were working in media. They were corporate women. They had supervisory positions. And they had wherewithal. So they weren't the kinds of people that we're talking about in terms of low-income workers. So from here, let's talk about Me Too. Me Too expressed what many writers that notice the women's movement and kind of the way that it's been framed in media, that really the people that are hashtag Me Too primarily were themselves media figures, and the people that they took down were horrifying talk show hosts and other notorious media figures. But the Me Too movement is almost a reflection, if you will, of some of the early programming of women in supervisory positions within media. Then you have a lot of media brouhaha about this book. It's called Lean In. Has anybody know that her argument is that so many times we prevent ourselves from succeeding and being leaders? We pull back when we should be leaning in. And so, of course, this is in a corporate setting. This is a person who doesn't have to worry about the retaliation from a supervisor. Most working women, certainly in the service and sectors, they would lose their jobs immediately if they leaned in. So these are people that have a certain amount of privilege. I'm quoting now from a New York Review of Books article by Alyssa Quart and Barbara Ehrenreich called Sisters in Arms, in which they talk about the divide between corporate middle-class feminism and the way that we need to really address also the issues of low-income working class women of color who are struggling in positions in which they are abused and sexually assaulted frequently. These are the people that are represented by the Me Too movement. And they contrast that with this book, In a Day's Work. And it's a wonderful woman who writes for Reveal. And so she wrote a book and she talked to immigrant women, office workers, farm workers. She talks to them. You know, a female farm worker was raped by her supervisor. A cleaning lady in Orange County was sexually assaulted, and another janitorial worker was subjected to continuing sexual assault. Most of the time, these women were the single heads of families. They had no way out of these jobs. They didn't really know their rights. And the article deals with this divide very interestingly. Now, the point that I would like to make is that what we find, however, is when women come together and organize for labor rights, they can't be ignored. Teacher strikes in Oklahoma and West Virginia have happened recently. The Me Too movement and a kind of a growing collective attitude toward organizing and challenging the politics of Trump and the new misogyny has in this moment taken a very interesting step forward. But we can't forget that women of color, as Steve argued, dominate the low-wage workforce. Females now are the majority of minimum wage workforce. Public and service sector unions in healthcare, public employment, food services, and public education are the fastest growing union sectors. And I think that the West Virginia teacher strike was a moment, a very important moment, in which white women, low-income, public sector women came together, united, and made demands, and they got a 5% raise. And they also got media coverage. So I think what we need to look to are collective solutions for systemic change. While the Me Too movement did a lot to raise awareness and lean in, and the kind of people represented in early television are really doing a good job, actually, but which somebody called trickle-down feminism, derogatorily, but it's much more important for middle-class women and corporate women who are fighting for their bodily autonomy and liberation. It's very important for us to unite this movement and somehow get together. So the barriers to systemic change, this comes from Port and Ehrenreich, and they argue that the mainstream women rights organizations employ Washington insiders, and they lobby, and that has failed to make systemic change for women. We've continued to lose ground in all major sectors where the public unions are organized, and it's been a losing battle. In the face of mounting inequality and conservative attacks on women's basic rights, we need a proliferation of independent grassroots feminist organizations and a return to the demands of social welfare feminism, universal health care, and free on-demand abortions. And just to say those kinds of things sounds very radical, but that's what we've been losing within the working class, and particularly with women, for three decades now, really. So lean-in feminism, another variant of corporate feminism, has failed the overwhelming majority of us. And we do not have access to individual self-promotion and advancement, as those conditions of life can be improved only through changing the policies of poverty. We need secure reproductive justice and guaranteed labor rights. So that's, I think, the only way that we can turn the Me Too movement into a diverse, you know, multicultural, people of color, men and women movement able to work toward change. How can we help unite the women's movement? How can we create more inclusivity? How can we shine a light on public sector and service industries worker with women and people of color? What was interesting is the Alyssa Cord, Barbara Ehrenreich piece did have a couple of solutions. And they said, well, women with means could have a legal fund. They could help the women that are featured, for example, in a day's work. They could help them with legal issues and bringing suits against the people who abuse them on the job. They also had some other ideas for digital media spaces or person-to-person spaces where members of the mainstream women's movement could get together and communicate and talk with women of color in low-wage working situations, or have a place, a digitally online place, where women of color could be and people could help facilitate them telling their stories and then attempting to get the word out in the press. So those were some of the ideas we've had, but I think it's safe to say that most of the women that I have identified in this talk, probably none of them voted for Trump. But we're still losing ground. we're under a certain amount of attack and misogyny. So I think if we did try to reunite and get rid of the class and race barriers within the women's movement, we'd have more of a chance of progressive change. Thank you.
Project Censored Show, and I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're playing excerpts from two workshops that took place at the Media Freedom Summit 2.0, Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice, held at the College of Marin, north of San Francisco, in late October this year. We just heard Robin Anderson speaking about class and feminism in media. For the next part of the program, we're going to shift gears and learn about a part of the world that gets little attention in most U.S. media, Kashmir. Since the end of British rule following World War II, Kashmir has been split between India, Pakistani, and Chinese control. India and Pakistan fought three wars over the territory, but Kashmiris have never been offered a chance to vote on their future. India, which controls the largest piece of Kashmir, has kept the area occupied with troops to put down secessionist activity. At the recent Media Freedom Summit, we held a workshop on Kashmir titled Storytelling from the Most Densely Militarized Land on Earth. The panelists were Kashmiri journalist Ifat Gazia and writer and radio reporter Tara Jarabji. We'll now hear part of that workshop.
I have been born and brought up in Kashmir. I lived my whole life there. On and off, I got a chance to get out, come in front of you, speak in front of you, but that's where I am based and that's where my family and my people are. Kashmir is a conflict zone. I was born in the outbreak of the conflict, actually, in early 90s. It was really very bad, and then we would hardly get to go to school. Never had like a normal school life where children go to school, you go to picnics, and you do different types of art or whatever. I always wanted to paint, but I never did it. Never anybody taught me, like, how to do it. I think I was 2.5 years old. This is, like, the first memory of me, of the Indian Army, and, like, why I was scared of them, and, you know, they do something to you and your family. So in Kashmir, it's not a practice right now. There are other ways to, obviously, have surveillance and torture people, but back then, in early 90s, they would ask people to get down from the bus near any military camp and ask the men to march. The woman would stay in the bus, the military will check the bus, and the men had to march till they crossed the premises of the military camp. So, obviously, my father had to get down as well. I was traveling with my mom and dad. My mom told my father that, you know, just take Ifat in your lap, because the military would randomly pick any guy and despair them, torture them, kill them. Depends on their mood. So she asked my father, take your daughter in your lap, maybe that way they won't pick you, you know. It was a very scary practice. So my father took me in his lap, and he is marching. The military man stopped him. First question was, why do you have a beard? And he said, I have always been like this. They slapped him. It was a very hard slap. The sound still resonates in my brain. They told him, you know what, we'll kill you right here and cook your daughter for dinner. And that was like the first traumatizing experience I remember, a memory. Obviously, maybe that time I only understood that I'm scared of this guy in the uniform. But later on, I realized what else it meant to me. So that was part of our life, like every day. And then I think I was less than 5 years old. My entire town, it was under a siege for like months, for 4 or 5 months. I mean, even if you Google it up, you'll have all the information, because that time, luckily, some international organizations were able to get into Kashmir and do the reporting part. There were just a few militants in the town. The military cordoned the whole area, asked everyone in the town to get out. I mean, they didn't allow us to get out of the boundaries of the town. They kept us like refugees in camps and in houses of other people, but did not allow anyone outside of our town to get into our town or let us get out of the town. And then they blew up the whole town, getting into helicopters, sprinkling with gunpowder and burning it ablaze to debris. It left nothing. And when we left our houses, even our clothes, everything was there. And I was a kid. I told my dad, I want my cycle. He said, just forget it. We left all our belongings. And when my town was burning, from a hill, we were just looking at it. There was a very big library. There was a historical shrine, which was thousands of years old. They just burned it into debris. And there was a huge library. I still remember the black pages, like burnt pages of books flying in the air. And it was really scary. And after they finished their operation, and we were living on the boundaries of the town, they got the dead bodies, put them in front of the military trucks, let the red blood ooze out of the white shrouds, and march in the areas where we're living in. And I still have that vivid memory in my brain. That's what I saw, and that's what I grew up. I have depression. I have, like, post-traumatic stress disorder. I tremble, and I get really nervous, and sometimes I just see dreams where military takes me, tortures me, and all of that. It's a part of my day-to-day life. But it's not just me. It's almost everybody in Kashmir. And it's so unfortunate that I lived to tell the stories of my past in my present, when my present is worse than my past, you know? And I really don't want that for the children who are right now in my present. I don't want to tell them the same stories in their future, like they'll have the same future as me. It's so heartbreaking. I mean, unless until we are in a situation, it's actually, I mean, people have solidarity, people have emotions, but unless until you're really in that situation, it's so hard to actually imagine ourselves, you know? Being 4-year-old and then bullets just going through your windows and your everything, and your parents ask you, just lie down on the floor, just lie down on the floor. I don't know what it means to, like, play normally, like going out, having picnics with your family. Basic survival is a problem. Kashmir gets shut down for months. My father was a businessman, and we so badly struggled with money. Because if you have a garment job in Kashmir, you sort of are safe. Because even if it's like 6 months curfew, the government still pays your salaries. But if you have a business to run and there's a curfew, of course you won't make any money. So it has been really hard. And in spite of all of this, I grew up and I was like, no, I want to tell stories. And I was really very interested in, like, visual storytelling. So I think I did not even know what it means. I was not a journalism student whatsoever. But in 2010, it was really bad in Kashmir. It was the worst uprising when the waves of unrest were strongly coming back and hitting Kashmir. It was in 2010. More than 120 people, young boys, died. And this is another unfortunate thing in all of this killing spree right now. Only children and young people are dying. There is no future left, basically. And in that uprising, a 7-year-old kid, he was brutally murdered in broad daylight. He was trampled under the boots of the security men just because he tried to cross the street and go to his uncle's place. It was a curfew. He was a child. His uncle lived across the street. He thought, I will just cross and go across the street and play with my cousins in their house. They got hold of him. They killed him. Everywhere on the Indian Channel, they said that it was a stampede. He died in a stampede. For God's sake, how can a stampede occur in curfew? You have shoot inside orders. Nobody is coming out. How can a stampede occur? So at that point of time, Facebook was very new. I was very new to Facebook. I met some people online, like 3-4 other people. And I said, you know, I really, really want to do something about it. I mean, we can't always just consume what they are producing and telling us. Right now, a spade is a spade. We have to do something about it. So in January 2011, I started, literally took a camera and started going out in the streets. You can see the documentary on YouTube. And I started going out on the street with the camera, asking the shopkeeper, do you know where Samira lives? Then asking other people, then one guy, you know, it's all rough footage. You will just see it. It was an amateur effort, but it really made a lot of impact. So I went to his house and his father told me the story. I went to the eyewitnesses. I went to the police. So got the whole narrative out that he did not die in a stampede. He was brutally murdered. And eyewitnesses really, like, you know, said the things like they were watching from their window and all of that. And his father, when he was telling me his story, he was crying, and literally I had to stop and get out in their corridor and cry as well, because this work really consumes you, because it's so personal. They are your people. You live there. They tell you their stories. It just doesn't affect you. It consumes you. Literally, it does. And the whole bunch of research after that I have been doing about different things as a journalist, as a researcher. I think it just takes a toll on your physical and mental health, really.
Tell us a little bit more about just the release of the film and how was it received?
I had no camera. I had no money. I didn't know how to do editing. So obviously I had to pay the editor to do the edits and make a documentary. So all year I asked my father, give me money. I have to buy biochemistry books. They're really expensive. He would be like, but you don't go to college. It's a just give me money. I want to study. You know, next year I have to apply to universities. Anyway, I would take the money, collect it, and then just give it to the editor. Because my parents had no idea that I'm making a film. If they had, they wouldn't allow me to get out. It's not safe for you. They're scared. And girls with a camera? Are you kidding? Anyway, Kashmir has changed a lot. There are a lot of photojournalists right now who are female. And I'm so happy. I mean, the change is coming, you know. When I made that documentary, I was like the first female who made a documentary. I had no money. I had a lot of debt. But the film went out, you know. I had no idea, like, how to sort of get money for editing or whatever. But it just worked. And I think I was really young. But the aftermath, it was really bad. In the sense, my phone started getting tapped and everything. I would call somebody and I could hear other people on the phone. But anyway, leaving that part aside, I sort of got ostracized. So many challenges at so many different levels.
When I was back in spring of 2018, I was there during Ramadan. There was a ceasefire. On the Friday night that I was there during the ceasefire, after the Friday night prayers, there was a young man who was run over by an army vehicle during a nonviolent protest and killed. And so the next day, there was like a shutdown called by the separatist leaders, and the whole town was there. And so the level of unrest was much higher than when I had been there before. And I think one of the key things was a week after I left, Shujaat Bukhari, a senior acclaimed journalist, was assassinated. And he had just come out of his office, and it was the day the UN report came out. And his last tweet was, India rejects UN report. And so I think that in terms of the work, the fear is absolutely tremendous.
Yeah, it totally is. After his assassination, I couldn't sleep for weeks. Anything would happen in my courtyard, I would just get up and, you know, try to control my breath. I thought somebody is coming to kill me as well. They are trying to change the discourse. They are trying to sort of delete it. They are trying to suppress our narrative. But it's people like Susan, Tara, who helped me coming in front of the world and sharing my story, because this doesn't happen often. And that's why maybe, unfortunately, whenever I talk to people in America, not everybody knows about Kashmir. It's a good thing that people know about Palestine and the conflict there, but they don't know what's happening in our lives. It's also a very old conflict. And one thing that really bothers me is that we always have so much solidarity with Palestine and Gaza. Anything happens there, Kashmiris go out on the streets, protest and get killed. And then I'm like, why doesn't it happen for us? I mean, Kashmiris are so loving, you know, but still we get killed. Anyway, there's a lot of fear, you know. There's a lot of fear, honestly. I was scared to death. I would walk on the street and I would just having that feeling that someone is watching you, you know. It's so scary. It's so scary. I thought they will plant a bomb or something underneath my car. And I'll have dreams like walking on the road and then hiding behind the bushes because a military truck came for me. So these things are really scary, that too on a daily basis.
Listening to the Project Censored Show, and I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We just heard audio excerpts from another of the workshops from our Media Freedom Summit 2.0, Critical Media Literacy for Social Justice. You can learn more about the event we held in late October at projectcensored.org. This recent session that you heard was titled Storytelling from the Most Densely Militarized Land on Earth, Kashmir. The panelists were Kashmiri journalist Ifat Ghazia and writer and radio reporter Tara Drabji. We'll now hear more of that workshop, including responses to questions from the audience.
I want to talk about how much censorship is there and how much surveillance is there. I mean, Facebook and Twitter, it really gave a space for people in Kashmir. We have no public spaces in Kashmir, by the way. After the militancy broke in 1990s, they burned down all the cinema halls, which is like a prime place for people to interact and meet, you know, a prime public sphere. I have never seen cinema halls in my life in Kashmir. People used to meet in cinema halls, have like outings and talk and watch movies. That was all over. The cinema halls were either burned down, they were either turned into torture centers or military camps. So That's really horrible. And then another prime place for people to meet and interact were the Sufi shrines. Women would actually go to shrines, sing and talk and, you know, share their stories. Women would really go out. But I never saw that thing when I was growing up. A lot of censorship. If you do anything, Facebook has given you that space that the cinema halls or the shrines haven't given you. Now you have online space where you can debate and talk about your frustrations and fears. But then there is also a lot of surveillance. Like how they easily put down your Facebook page or Twitter page or block it for days. And yes, another irony in Kashmir, so many internet blackouts. And it's not for a day. It's for like weeks or months. Even right now, there is no 4G in Kashmir, which means I cannot do video calls with my parents. It's just in their hand. They do it every minute. They do it every minute. They're like, we don't want any crowds to assemble. We don't want the news to spread. But it happens anyway. And in the worst way, more and more people have this sentiment of picking up guns in Kashmir. Never before have so many young boys of my age, much younger than me, picked up guns, well-educated, studying medicine, studying engineering, and intellectuals and PhDs, picking up guns, becoming militants and getting killed. Because you can't suppress a community for long. There has to be a retaliation. I am doing my resistance in a different way, maybe because I don't believe in bloodshed. I don't want any more blood to be to be wasted. But they do their resistance their own way. But it's like every Kashmiri is resisting, each and every one of us. And I like, mostly it's us, like people of my generation, because we don't want our future to be like this. We want to change it for coming generation or the kids who are there right now. There's a lot of fake news. For example, whatever you see on Indian television channels. The irony is Kashmir doesn't have its own television channels. There used to be some. The Indian government banned it. Luckily, have some newspapers, and they sometimes ban the newspapers as well. So the narrative that goes out to the world, and that's there in the minds of the sane Indians, it's what the national Indian television is feeding them. So whenever you talk to somebody from India, their first question would be, is it safe for tourists? Why do you say safe for tourists? I am really amazed. Nobody ever said that, is it safe for you guys to live? Because if you look at the statistics, never any tourist has been hurt in Kashmir, be it from India or anywhere else. But Kashmiri people die every day. But I don't blame those Indians because it's what their television is feeding them. It's all propaganda news. Something else happens in Kashmir and they show something else on their TV. So it's frustrating. I don't watch it at all.
I'm from Punjab region of India. And I've been familiar with the situation in Kashmir. So, as you said, the Indian media is biased and they cannot trust the information. And I know, like, most of the information that comes out of Kashmir is censored. But there is a general view of all other states in India that this is propaganda by Pakistan, which is funding militants in Kashmir and trying to take over Kashmir from India.
I don't know who is funding militancy and what lavish life militants are living. I don't know. I just know that more and more Kashmiri young boys are getting killed. And as far as I am concerned, I can't speak on behalf of everyone. I equally don't want to be a part of Pakistan as equally I don't want to be a part of India. I mean, we are self-sustainable. Kashmiris have always been independent and they have been separate. Just because India got independence from British, they thought, okay, that colony is over, now let's colonize Kashmir, you know? But that's not okay. I want Kashmir to be independent. And really, you know, most of the electricity in North India, it comes from Kashmir. And we don't have electricity for ourselves in the harsh winters. We don't have, you know what you have here, central heating systems and everything. We don't have it. We don't have even electricity. We have to use candles in winters. And our electricity, that comes from our dams, our water, it goes to India. So if we are independent, we are just fine. There is no improvement, you know. There's nothing I can say. It is just, look at the pictures of Kashmir like 50 years before and now see now. You'll see the difference. It's far better 50 years before than it's right now. So that should tell you what the reality is. So I don't associate myself with Pakistan. I don't associate myself with India. Having an Indian passport is like the biggest trauma one can have. Mm-hmm. Because I don't identify myself as an Indian. But when I apply for a university or anywhere, I have to write in my nationality that I am Indian and there is no option that I am a Kashmiri. And just imagine yourself in that situation, saying that I belong to my oppressor. I don't. What is your name?
Lakhvir.
Yeah, okay, Lakhvir. Because you are from India, you can do me a favor. So, you know, so many Indians have asked me this question because they get angry because we want to be with Pakistan. Just tell them, you know, if they do a referendum, we don't equally want to be a part of India or Pakistan. We want to be independent. Here we are talking more about like what Indian military does in Kashmir, you know. So they enjoy huge impunity for torturing people, for disappearing people. There are thousands of people who are disappeared, and their wives live as half widows. So half widow is a woman who doesn't know if her husband is alive or dead, so she has to wait for her husband, and then she has, you can say, half orphans. So there's a lot of poverty. I don't know who supports what movements where, but I know there's a lot of poverty, but Kashmiris are very upright, you know. At least everybody has a roof on their head, because as a community, we take care of each other. I mean, you might not have the best of lifestyle and best of everything, but we make sure our neighbor eats his dinner or her dinner. So all these orphans and these women whose husbands have been tortured, whose husbands or family members have been disappeared, they are really in very bad economic conditions. I mean, I have my research to support the same. It's not something I'm just throwing an assumption, because I have went to the families, I have seen the people. If anyone in the family has been directly affected by the conflict, they really live a bad life.
Can you talk a little bit how gender affects the ways people resist occupation, and then also just your experience that you've had as a woman doing this work as well within patriarchal systems?
Like I said, I made that documentary and it was very well acclaimed and everything, and then came the reality part. Most of my relatives, they cut off relations with my family, and my parents were under so much pressure. They were like, what good family girl does that? You know, she has not been a good girl who takes a camera and goes and interviews policemen and then says things about military and, you know, all of that. All good girls, they become doctors or they become teachers, like my other cousins are. I'm the only one in my entire clan who chose to do something like this. I was the first girl in my entire district to actually take up journalism. I was the first girl in my entire town to drive. When I would go out with the car, people will actually stare. And now so many girls drive there, you know. When I go back home, it's like just overwhelming to see like how Kashmir is changing. Even they are trying to suppress us more and more. But, you know, people have given up on fair. They are like, oh, let's just do whatever. But it's not just fair. There definitely is patriarchy. I won't deny that. Abuse is hurled at me like, why did you do that? Good girls don't do that. And then the real shocker came and I said, I'm going to London. They're like, okay, you get married, then go wherever you want to go with your husband. I said, that's not happening. I mean, I know my husband from 11 years. We met in school. We got married last year. And he is the best person in my life. He's so supportive. He supports all these trips I do. He's like, this is the least he can do for Kashmir, you know? So he said, it's fine. You just go to London. He came to America for his studies. I went to London. My father supported me. I'm talking about my relatives, you know. They told my parents, you're bringing shame to our family. You're sending her out. I just think I'm extremely lucky to have my parents and my husband who supported me and told me, no, you can go anywhere and do whatever. But like I said, 99.99% girls in Kashmir still struggle with the same. They are not allowed to even go to India for education or abroad. Of course, Kashmiri girls are everywhere, but you know, there's a small percentage in most of the families. Like I just said, those students sending me emails that can they do something from the premises of their home, because they're not allowed to go even outside for jobs. So there is a lot of control, not that your own parents have on your life, but society has on your life. And God forbid if you happen to do something I do, leaving home like at 7 a.m. and coming back at 11 a.m., traveling to different districts of Kashmir and gathering stories, the neighbors will be like, oh, she's not parking her car. Where was she? People have a lot of interest in your life. So it gives me a lot of stress. Definitely, I'm not strong. I would not lie to you. But I feel like I give preference to my work over my anxieties and my stress. I think that's really important.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign.
I'd like to thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, co-founder and executive producer of The Project Censored Show. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. We'd like to thank all of our engineers around the country, particularly Erica Bridgman at KPFA. We'd also like to remind listeners that they can find archives of the Project Censored Show online at projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook and Twitter at Project Censored. Feel free to contact us through projectcensored.org. We do like to hear feedback about the programs and other ideas for things you think we should be covering regarding the news that didn't make the news. The Project Censored Show airs on close to 50 stations around the United States. And to support our program and to learn more, go to projectcensored.org. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Got the skies like an ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys. And the weapons bring effects paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons fill the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that mission. We want a crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. Yeah, we want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We got the love of lift our brothers and our sisters. One, the people together can overthrow the system. One, we got the love of lift our brothers and our sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Fire and the Underground Life in the Forest, Peter Wohlleben and Suzanne Simard. As California tries to come to terms with the largest and deadliest fires of 2018, attention falls on forests. Logging companies want more clear cuts. Donald Trump says the forest floor should be cleaned with rakes. Indigenous elders and visionary foresters say that nobody is asking the trees what they want and need, especially now as the heat is rising, water becomes scarce, and winds are fiercer. Peter Wohlleben is the author of The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate, Discoveries from a Secret World. He's a German forester who became disenchanted by the technologies he was expected to employ, including the felling of old-growth trees and the use of insecticides. He now manages a 4,000-year-old beech tree forest in Germany. People can buy a tree as a headstone for burial. He was interviewed by Steve Piken on The Agenda in October 2016.
Are trees able to form friendships? Can forests have moods? Do trees warn each other of danger? You may think these are ridiculous questions to ask, but forester Peter Wohlleben presents a compelling scientific case for these and other surprising discoveries. It's all in his book, The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate. And Peter Wohlleben joins us now. It's great to have you here. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
What made you even think to consider studying this issue?
In the first, years, I was a normal forester, and I know about tree feelings as much as a butcher about animal feelings. Mm-hmm. And that's also, knowing too much about it, it's bad for the business. But In my forest district, we created a burial forest, a forest where people may be buried in urns. I did it to rescue this old forest. It's a 4,000-year-old beech tree forest, and the people can buy their trees as a living headstone. And and then together with those people, my view became a better one, not just as a forester, but I saw trees once again as wonderful beings and not just as raw materials for the next sawmill. And together with those people, I discovered new things in the forest. And then I discovered that, for example, that a very old at first, it looks to me like a stone, a moss-covered stone, and it turns out to be the remnant of an old tree stump. The tree has been felled 400 or 500 years ago, and this old stump is still living. The question is, how can that be? It burns sugar in its cells, like we do, without any green leaf. So where came the nutrition from where? And the only explanation is that the surrounding neighbor trees supporting this old fellow to keep it alive.
I want to read an excerpt from your book here. Yeah. So here we go. A pair of true friends is careful right from the outset not to grow overly thick branches in each other's direction. The trees don't want to take anything away from each other. And so they develop sturdy branches only at the outer edges of their crowns. That is to say, only in the direction of non-friends. Such partners are often so tightly connected at the roots that sometimes they even die together. How do you think trees develop these, as you call them, friendships?
Trees are able to detect which sort of tree is standing beside. For example, a mother tree is able to detect its own childs, its own seedlings. In the root tips, there are brain-like structures. University of Bonn is doing research on this. That sounds esoteric, like Lord of the Rings, like the Ents or so, but that's reality, that's a fact. They have brain-like structures and there are brain-like processes going on. And with those root tips, they are able to see, that's my relative, a family member, that are my children, or that is a tree which may become a friend. That happens not very often, perhaps in one of 50 cases, because you're not able to move as a tree. And when the tree next to you is not nice to you, then it won't be a friend. And for the rest of your lifetime, you are a lonely tree. But sometimes it matches, and then those trees combine their root system and work together as being a whole a single tree.
When you are walking through a forest, can you just tell with the naked eye these two are friends?
Yeah.
These two are friends?
Yeah.
You can tell?
Yeah, and hopefully the readers are afterwards also able to do. Because it's really easy to detect it. You just have to watch above you in the crowns, and then you see trees which are working together, bring the branches just in the outside. And trees which are no friends, they shrink their thick branches, they struggle a little bit for light. And real friends don't do that. They don't disturb each other. Yeah, and you can see that on your own, and perhaps all readers.
Are some trees more social than other trees?
Really, yeah. You can see that the best when you're watching old stumps. There are not all old stumps are supported in the way I described it. There are some stumps which rot away very fast and go back to earth like humus. And those stumps, you can say they are lone wolves, which like we have it in the human society. There are always people who want to have to do nothing with other people, and these things you can also find among trees.
But can you tell, for example, that a maple tree is more friendly than a cedar tree or a pine tree than a birch tree?
Yeah, you can say that. That depends on the species. For example, a birch tree likes to live on its own. And when there's a neighboring tree stands beside it, the birch tree has hanging branches which are working like wipes. And when the wind is going through, it wipes the branches from the neighbor tree away. We have such a pair, the Douglas fir and a birch in my garden. And the birch wiped out the branches from the Douglas fir in the shape of the birch crown. Hmm. So, birch is a little aggressive.
Is that because it's a hardwood, or that has nothing to do with
it? No, it has nothing to do with it. Birch trees used to live on their own because They are the first ones to settle on new land. And there, on new land, there is no forest, and you have to compete, you have to be fast. And so, because they are exhausted within 100 years, after 100 years, and that's a short period, a short time for a tree, mm-hmm. then they will die. And so they are not so social like Douglas fir or beech trees or maple or whatsoever.
Since trees are alive, obviously, and since, as you've told us, through ultrasonic waves, they scream in a certain way, do you know whether they feel pain when they get chopped down?
Yeah, really. I think they feel pain. When we chop a tree, then we think the tree is dead. But what is the tree? Is, for example, is a trunk? Perhaps it's nothing else than a big trunk, big metal thing with solar cells on it. And the real tree is in the soil. Hmm. We don't know it. We don't know where a tree stores its memories. And when I told you that a tree has in its root tips brain-like structures, perhaps that's the main thing on trees. And when you chop down a tree, you just chop down its solar cells. And the bigger part of the tree, the most important part of the tree, is still there. And that's perhaps the reason why it is supported by the neighbor trees.
I know what the World Wide Web is. What is the Wood Wide Web?
The Wood Wide Web is the combination of root and fungi network in the forest. Fungi network, fungi are not able to feed themselves like plants. So scientists don't know whether they are animals or plants. And so they say the whole world is on animals, plants, and fungi. So the fungi are growing in the soil. In one teaspoon full of earth, you have several miles of fungi filaments. And the fungi are connecting the trees and transporting, for example, news from one tree to another. And therefore, they get sugar solution. They are getting paid for it. And they are very expensive because a tree has to pay as much as 1/3 of the whole photosynthesis production. Mm. That's as much as a tree stores in form of timber. So it's a very expensive wood wide web, but it works.
How far can those messages go?
We don't know. Fungi can become very big, several square miles in size. And the research is still on its way, how far it goes, what news are transported, and that are not just news, and also sugar solution. Because the trees are not just supporting themselves via a root network, but also on this fungi network. And the fungi is not always working proper. It has its own strategy. For example, when it should transport sugar from one beech tree to another, sometimes it's getting some sugar to other tree species because perhaps one day, the beech trees will die. And then the fungi will die too because it relays on trees. And when there's another species living in this forest, the fungi may survive, and therefore they're supporting, although they are not supposed to do so, other species.
Why do you think it's important for us to know what trees are saying?
That's important for two things. Because when we, on one hand, it's better to know that because we can manage forests in a better way. Healthy forests produce more and better timber, and produce more oxygen and are more stable in storms and fire and so on. But on the other hand, it's more fun for us. We may enjoy it. For example, when you look at an elephant, you don't ask what benefits give it to us. We just say, oh, what a wonderful being. Mm. And when you look on a plant elephant, and trees are plant elephants, the biggest plants that we have, and you know all those wonderful things, I think you will have a lot of fun when you walk through the forest.
A lot of fun, but do you want us to change the way we deal with trees?
Yeah, that would be a great thing. I think when people begin to love trees and look at them like on elephants, then they won't waste paper for things which are not worthful. They perhaps will reduce a little consumption, and when they buy things based on timber, then perhaps from better managed forests.
Let's do one more quote before we leave today. It is okay to use wood as long as the trees are allowed to live in a way that is appropriate to their species. And that means that they should be allowed to fulfill their social needs. to grow in a true forest environment on undisturbed ground and to pass their knowledge on to the next generation. And at least some of them should be allowed to grow old with dignity and finally die a natural death. It does make me wonder whether you're at all guilty for the trees that had to die to make this book. What do you think?
And that's I'm also heating with firewood. I'm a human being. I'm not able to make photosynthesis. And for example, when you eat breakfast, you need farmland, and there once stood a primeval forest. So the question is, what are our rights? What are the rights of the trees? And I think we have to get it in a better balance. And then it's okay to use wood. Wood is a really great stuff to make a table out of timber or to heat with wood. But I think we should leave some land, some preserves for trees so that they are able to live in family bands and so that we have fun to watch them how they live.
Ausgezeichnet. Dankeschön, Peter. That was fabulous. Peter Wohlleben, The Hidden Life of Trees. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Peter Wohlleben interviewed by Steve Paikin on The Agenda in October 2016. Wohlleben referred to research by colleagues and scientists that he benefited from. Important among them is Suzanne Simard, professor of forest ecology. She teaches at the University of British Columbia. She has tested theories about how trees communicate with other trees. She used radioactive carbon to measure the flow and sharing of carbon between individual trees and species. Simard also helped identify something called a hub tree, or mother tree. They are the largest trees in forests that act as central hubs for vast below-ground mycorrhizal networks. Here's a short clip from a documentary by Dan McKinney, followed by quotes from her frequent presentations on TED Talks.
I'm a forester, specialized into looking at below-ground communities. We found that these fungi actually will connect one plant to another plant. This tree here has got roots growing out everywhere, and as we get further away from the tree, we're more likely to find its roots, the ones that are involved in this trade. This is where the fungi hunt or scavenge for nutrients. So the tree sends down its carbon, it goes through the root system and through into these fungi, and there's an interface between the root cortical cells and the fungal cell that's wrapped itself around that cortical cell, and that's where this exchange goes on. The mother trees we think of as the big old trees. They catch your eye when you walk into a forest. This Douglas fir is about 500 years old. It's a massive tree that will have an enormous network associated with it. So you could think of this as a mother tree. You know, it's in the sense that it's a dominant tree in the forest. It's probably networked into all of the trees all around it, even though they're of different species. So this tree is probably linked over to trees as far as you can see. It's just that there are trees in between that are the bridges for the network. Forest ecosystems are really complex systems, just like the Earth is a complex system, the biosphere. And the way it works is that we have all these parts, and all these parts are working together, like the fungus is working together with the tree. It's a lot like how our brains work. In neural networks, our brains are comprised of neurons and axons, and these neurons are physically related, but they're also, you know, almost metaphysically related because they're sending messages back and forth and they're building upon each other. It works a lot like a forest ecosystem, and that diversity is really what gives the forest resilience, the resilience to withstand unexpected events like a fire that might come through or an insect or a windstorm. Well, somebody's going to be left standing because there's a diversity there. Some of the forest practices that we have done pay no attention to the role of these mother trees, or that trees actually will move some of their legacy to the new generation. We didn't pay attention to it. Instead, what we did is we went and cut down those trees after they died so that we could make 2x4s out of them. And we didn't give them a chance to give back to the community, I don't think. So what those dying trees will do is that they will also move resources into living trees, to the young ones coming up before they go, before they completely collapse. It's a transfer, like a passing of the wand from one generation to the next, if we allow it to happen.
Imagine you're walking through a forest. I'm guessing you're thinking of a collection of trees, what we foresters call a stand, with their rugged stems and their beautiful crowns. Yes, trees are the foundation of forests, but a forest is much more than what you see. And today, I want to change the way you think about forests. You see, underground, there is this other world, a world of infinite biological pathways that connect trees and allow them to communicate, and allow the forest to behave as though it's a single organism. It might remind you of a sort of intelligence. How do I know this? Here's my story. I grew up in the forests of British Columbia. I used to lay on the forest floor and stare up at the tree crowns. They were giants. My grandfather was a giant too. He was a horse logger, and he used to selectively cut cedar poles from the inland rainforests. Grandpa taught me about the quiet and cohesive ways of the woods and how my family was knit into it. So I followed in Grandpa's footsteps. He and I had this curiosity about forests. So I studied forestry. But soon I found myself working alongside the powerful people in charge of the commercial harvest. The extent of the clear-cutting was alarming, and I soon found myself conflicted by my part in it. Not only that, the spraying and hacking of the aspens and birches to make way for the more commercially valuable planted pines and firs was astounding. It seemed that nothing could stop this relentless industrial machine. So I went back to school, and I studied my other world. You see, scientists had just discovered in the laboratory in vitro that one pine seedling root could transmit carbon to another pine seedling root. But this was in the laboratory, and I wondered, could this happen in real forests? I thought, yes. Trees in real forests might also share information below ground. But this was really controversial, and some people thought I was crazy. And I had a really hard time getting research funding. But I persevered, and I eventually conducted some experiments deep in the forest 25 years ago. The evidence was clear. The C13 and C14 was showing me that paper birch and Douglas fir were in a lively two-way conversation. It turns out at that time of the year in the summer that birch was sending more carbon to fir than fir was sending back to birch, especially when the fir was shaded. And then in later experiments, we found the opposite, that fir was sending more carbon to birch than birch was sending to fir. And this was because the fir was still growing while the birch was leafless. So it turns out the two species were interdependent, like yin and yang. And at that moment, everything came into focus for me. I knew I'd found something big, something that would change the way we look at how trees interact in forests, from not just competitors, but to cooperators. And I had found solid evidence of this massive below-ground communications network, the other world. Now, I truly hoped and believed that my discovery would change how we practice forestry, from clear-cutting and herbiciding to more holistic and sustainable methods, methods that were less expensive and more practical. What was I thinking? I'll come back to that. Now, I want to talk about the science. How were paper birch and Douglas fir communicating? Well, it turns out they were conversing not only in the language of carbon, but also nitrogen and phosphorus and water and defense signals and allele chemicals and hormones, information. And you know, I have to tell you, before me, scientists had thought that this below-ground mutualistic symbiosis called a mycorrhiza was involved. Mycorrhiza literally means fungus root. You see their reproductive organs when you walk through the forest. They're the mushrooms. The mushrooms, though, are just the tip of the iceberg, because coming out of those stems are fungal threads that form a mycelium, and that mycelium infects and colonizes the roots of all the trees and plants. And where the fungal cells interact with the root cells, there's a trade of carbon for nutrients. And that fungus gets those nutrients by growing through the soil and coating every soil particle. The web is so dense that there can be hundreds of kilometers of mycelium under a single footstep. And not only that mycelium connects different individuals in the forest. Individuals not only of the same species, but between species, like birch and fir. And it works kind of like the internet. You see, like all networks, mycorrhizal networks have nodes and links. In a single forest, a mother tree can be connected to hundreds of other trees. And using our isotope tracers, we have found that mother trees will send their excess carbon through the mycorrhizal network to the understory seedlings. And we've associated this with increased seedling survival by 4 times. Now, we know we all favor our own children. And I wondered, could Douglas fir recognize its own kin? Like Mama Grizzly and her cub? So we set about an experiment, and we grew mother trees with kin and stranger seedlings. And it turns out they do recognize their kin. Mother trees colonize their kin with bigger mycorrhizal networks. They send them more carbon below ground. They even reduce their own root competition to make elbow room for their kids. When mother trees are injured or dying, they also send messages, wisdom, onto the next generation of seedlings. So we've used isotope tracing to trace carbon moving from an injured mother tree down her trunk into the mycorrhizal network and into her neighboring seedlings. Not only carbon, but also defense signals. And these two compounds have increased the resistance of those seedlings to future stresses. So trees talk. Thank you. So let's come back to the initial point. Forests aren't simply collections of trees. They're complex systems with hubs and networks that overlap and connect trees and allow them to communicate, and they provide avenues for feedbacks and adaptation. And this makes the forest resilient. That's because there are many hub trees and many overlapping networks. But they're also vulnerable. Vulnerable not only to natural disturbances, like bark beetles that preferentially attack big old trees, but high-grade logging and clear-cut logging. You see, you can take out one or two hub trees, but there comes a tipping point. Because hub trees are not unlike rivets in an airplane. You can take out one or two, and the plane still flies. But you take out one too many, or maybe that one holding on the wings, and the whole system collapses. These simplified forests lack complexity, and they're really vulnerable to infections and bugs. And as climate changes, this is creating a perfect storm. For extreme events, like the massive mountain pine beetle outbreak that just swept across North America, or that mega fire in the last couple of months in Alberta. So I want to come back to my final question. Instead of weakening our forests, how can we reinforce them and help them deal with climate change? Well, you know what the great thing about forests as complex systems is? They have enormous capacity to self-heal. In our recent experiments, we found with patch cutting and retention of hub trees and regeneration to a diversity of species and genes and genotypes, that these mycorrhizal networks, they recover really rapidly. So with this in mind, I want to leave you with 4 simple solutions. And we can't kid ourselves that these are too complicated to act on. First, we all need to get out in the forest. We need to reestablish local involvement in our own forests. You see, most of our forests now are managed using a one-size-fits-all approach. But good forest stewardship requires knowledge of local conditions. Second, we need to save our old-growth forests. These are the repositories of genes and mother trees and mycorrhizal networks. So this means less cutting. I don't mean no cutting, but less cutting. And third, when we do cut, we need to save the legacies, the mother trees and networks and the wood, the genes, so they can pass their wisdom on to the next generation of trees, so they can withstand the future stresses coming down the road. We need to be conservationists. And finally, fourthly and finally, we need to regenerate our forests with a diversity of species and genotypes and structures by planting and allowing natural regeneration. We have to give Mother Nature the tools she needs to use her intelligence to self-heal. And we need to remember that forests aren't just a bunch of trees competing with each other. They're super cooperators. I hope today to have changed how you think about forests. Thank you.
That was Suzanne Simard, a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. Before her, you heard from the forester Peter Wohlleben. Both have been seen on YouTube and TED Talks. You heard Fire and the Underground Life in the Forest. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio's free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. When a personal journal is written, it is often not meant for the eyes of anyone but the writer. Yet when a stranger's journal is read, the reader often becomes a voyeur of the innermost secrets of another. And whether it is the true journal of another or fiction, who cares? It often remains a good story. Lynn Freed, originally from Durban, South Africa, has written the fictional journal of Agnes LaGrange entitled The Mirror, which reveals the thoughts, feelings, and loves of Agnes, starting when she arrived in South Africa to work as a housekeeper and ending 50 years later. I spoke with Lynn Freed in December of 1997 from her home in rural Northern California and asked her, who is Agnes LaGrange?
Agnes LaGrange is a character who came to me, and I don't generally make this kind of claim for my fiction, but anyway, she did arrive, at least she arrived by way of her voice, in a situation that I was writing a short story around, which is the arrival of a young English woman, working class English woman, to South Africa in 1920 to work as a housekeeper, really a glorified maid for a family of Lithuanian Jews, in the process of which she has an affair with the old man and starts, as she puts it, making her way in the world. Anyway, I had this situation in mind to write about, and once I came to write about it, her voice was just there, and I wrote a short story around this, a very short one, which actually constitutes the first chapter and was published in Harper's a couple of years ago. And then when I was moving on to start writing a novel, it was her voice that was still with me, and I took her along into the novel, and that's how it began, really, and that's how I came to this character, who I suppose, like all characters, including dogs and cats, is an aspect of oneself, but she's not me. Sometimes I wish she were, but she isn't.
And you present this character in a voyeuristic way. When one looks at the mirror, it's like one is picking up another person's journal, Agnes's journal, and you go into the intimacy of her life and her thoughts.
Right. Yes. And once I had her voice, and it was a voice really like a spoken journal voice, or somebody who is writing in a journal, it does have that feeling of voyeurism, which of course ties in with the mirror motif, which I tried not to, and I hope did not, overplay in the novel. This is a young woman who's actually never seen an image of herself at the beginning of the novel, and is given a full-length mirror by her employer in which she sees herself for the first time and falls in love with herself. And through the mirror, she comes to an understanding of herself as a woman, her sexual prowess and her other kinds of prowess. But anyway, it does fit with this kind of, as you would say, voyeuristic feel to the read of the novel, which is also added to, by the way, that Crown published the novel as a journal. It looks like a journal. It holds in the hand like a journal. It's got old photographs included in it. So it has a kind of a memoir feel to it, which is just exactly what I intended.
Are these photographs yours?
No. Some of them are mine. Some of them I got from old family photographs and so forth, but the bulk of them were obtained from the local history museum in Durban.
The characters in the novel, very few of them have names. Many of them are characters, the hunter, the tycoon, the newspaper man who was her husband, but he's nameless in the novel.
Right. I didn't actually think this through as I was writing it. The newspaper man came as such because before she knew his name, presuming she did, she thought of him as the newspaper man. They were both residents in a rather run-down hotel near the railway. And then she happened to marry him, and somehow it seemed right that he remained in her consciousness as the newspaper man. She never really had an intimate relationship with this man. And then somehow that's the way she seemed to consider all men, I think. And by the way, there's also a woman who's never named, the mother-in-law. But I've heard a lot from women who've read this novel, and they've said, you know, good Lord, this is so often the way women consider men. I don't think men really understand that. There's been a lot of literature from men about how they feel about women, which is really just this way.
What do you mean?
What I mean is that women are seen as what they stand for. By the way, I didn't think of any of this while I was writing it. It just seemed that this was the kind of woman who would think of a man as a newspaper man, a hunter, a banker, a tycoon. But in fact, I'm sorry, I'm at a loss to think of an example, but something may come as we talk, of fiction that's written about men. Say Don Juan types, she is not the equivalent, but men who've had several women, in which the women really are not who they are, but what they are, what they represent to that particular man on his quest for self-knowledge, one would hope.
An object instead of a person?
Yes. I don't give it any judgment, here or otherwise, but yes, I think that you could say that.
In your personal experience, you're a native of Durban, South Africa.
Right.
What do you draw on for painting the picture in the mirror?
I draw on that deep memory that somehow miraculously tends to come to one when one is writing fiction properly, and somehow eludes one when one is struggling and cannot get it right. In this case, it was a territory I knew well in another era, which is namely, you know, the era that I grew up in, 50s, 60s, 70s and on. But it was so evident to me as I was writing this, and I was using a lot of the visual aids, I used a lot of architectural histories, histories of Durban and so forth, just to see the way people dressed, the way they looked, the way the place looked. It wasn't difficult. I had never even thought of writing any kind of historical fiction, and I wouldn't really think of this as historical fiction as such, but until I wrote this, and once I was doing it, it was really quite easy. Then with the second draft and so forth, I checked up on the facts. And I just had a letter, in fact, last week from a 90-year-old woman who lives in Philadelphia, who grew up in Durban in the 30s and said I had got it exactly right. And so it was pleasing to me, really pleasing.
Really? That must be.
Yeah.
That must be. When you draw on the deep memory of your background, is there a way of sparking that or turning on the lights in that memory so that it can drop out of the tip of your pencil?
I don't know what to say. You know, I teach writing every now and then, and this is a question that students often ask because of course it's the situation one wants to be in when one's writing fiction, and it's the situation one can't get into when one is blocked from writing fiction or anything else. I think really what brings the deep memory is sitting down and writing, struggling with it until you have the voice right, and the character that comes with the voice, and the situation that comes with the character that has the voice, and then somehow one is in the territory of the fiction. One has to inhabit the fiction, the territory of one's fiction, in order to have it live on the page. And I don't think this is something that you can wish onto the page. It's something you have to work for. And then it sort of comes to you. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Thucydides who said, "Inspiration visits you." No, it couldn't have been Thucydides. "Inspiration visits you while you're firmly seated at your desk." And I think that is indeed the case.
And that is when the voice resounds?
Yes. If you're lucky. I mean, there are many things that one writes and fails at. But if you get it right, if it is a territory which you can inhabit or colonize, whichever metaphor works for you, and of which you're not afraid, then I think the fiction has a chance. But there are so many ineffable things that are involved in the writing of fiction that it's very hard to pinpoint, say, just the territory of the fiction or just the character or just the voice. It's a kind of a confluence that has to happen if the fiction's going to be right. And if it's wrong, you have to call on years and years of craft to fix the bits where it doesn't exactly flow, because, of course, it doesn't most of the time. Most of the time, one's fixing.
You've made a point of saying that Agnes LaGrange is not Lynn Freed, that this is not at all autobiographical.
Well, I wouldn't say not at all autobiographical, because, in fact, everything one writes, I think, is autobiographical. It comes through one's consciousness. But this is a character who, if she has any connection with me, is an aspect of myself, much as if one is writing a play, for instance. Every character on the stage is an aspect of oneself or an aspect of one person. So, yes, I would say this is a character I understand well, and that in another life I could be, but that in this life I'm not her. I think that's about the best I can do with
this. Would wish fulfillment be a proper phrase?
That's probably part of it, not a huge part, because when one writes a wish-fulfilling character, that character is very often two-dimensional. I see a lot of that in fiction that I read of students, you know, that they wish to create a character and they have the idea of the character, and then somehow that character feels painted onto the page, but not too well. It's a problem.
Lynn, I'd like to ask you, if you could, to please read a portion of The Mirror for us.
I'll read a bit where Agnes is leaving her husband and small child, temporarily anyway. The child's name is Leah, and the husband is the newspaper man, to go off and visit her lover, who is a hunter and lives inland in southern Africa, north of South Africa, probably in what was Rhodesia. And she's off on a train. It was a tiring journey, 3 days in the heat, switching and changing and showing my papers for stamping, But it was lovely, too, stopping at the little towns and then the plains of yellow grass and the umbrella trees and the mountains blue in the distance. After a while, there were even animals to see, zebras and antelopes and giraffes with their babies, all looking up as we passed as if we were interrupting their tea. And every now and then the native children would come running from their kraals and dance next to the train, holding out their hands for sweets. I had a coupe to myself all the way, and all the time in the world to think of where I was going, what I was leaving behind. And the funny thing was, now that I was going to see the hunter, I wasn't at all sure I wanted him. And so what was the point of the journey? To punish the newspaper man for things he'd said to me in anger, all of which were true? Truly, it was Leah who was punished, and by mistake too. And when I thought of this, I was sad all over again, marooned in my coupe moving north through this vast continent, because I was willful and adventurous, and I wouldn't give up what I wanted. And then at last I arrived, and there he was, waiting on the platform, which wasn't even a platform, but a mound to step down onto. By now I was mad for him to make sense of the journey, for me to grab me up and tell me things I'd never thought of that way before. But instead he was saying, "Did you not receive my telegram? And perhaps you aren't aware." And by the time I was loaded with my things into his jalopy, I was full of pity for myself, and close to tears too, which is the thing I knew he hated in a woman. There were to be two nights and a day together, said he, as we bumped along, and then he'd have to be off for a fortnight. And no, he couldn't take me with him. What was I thinking? I'd have to stay in the house with the servants, but it was no place for a white woman, and no place for a holiday either. I just sat beside him, hanging on to the strap with both hands, because the road wasn't a road at all, just tracks in the dust. And not once had he touched me except to hand me up into the jalopy, and I didn't need his warnings about white women and so forth to know that he didn't want me there at all. I was his girl at the port 2 or 3 times a year, and I felt stupid now for the distance I'd travelled and all the letters I'd sent, the things I'd thought he'd want to hear about me. "Are you cross?" said he, smiling at last, a hand coming over to take mine. But I didn't like this either, the smile brought on by my setting myself against him. And so I told him this, and loudly too, and it was then that he laughed and stopped the jalopy and pulled me over to him. I didn't pout, that was never my way, but even though it was lovely to have the smell of him again and the bitter taste of his tobacco, still I was calculating when the next ship would sail south from Beira, thinking I'd plumb for that. It would be a lovely way to go back. It was sundown when we arrived at his house, with a great hallooing and the natives running out to stare at me. One woman stood apart with a half-breed child strapped to her back and another standing at her side. He said something to her in her language and she stepped forward looking down at the ground. I knew then that the children must be his and the mother suffering to see me. She was very black and smooth, with gleaming, round, full breasts and a beaded cloth tied round her hips, and the thought of them together filled me with longing. He must have known this, because he took me inside, had everything off me at once, even the pins out of my hair. It was dark in the house, hardly a house at all, really, just 2 rooms and a roof made with mud and wooden poles and thatching. It smelled of earth and animal skins and the primus and his tobacco. He hooked up the cloths that closed off the bedroom from the veranda, letting in the last of the afternoon light. "Come," said he, leading me naked out onto the veranda and pointing to a watering hole down the hill, the animals coming in to drink, this kind and that kind, which I pretended to see, but all I could think of was him behind me, breathing on my hair, the salt of his arm when I licked it, and how 2 things could be felt at once, one for this night and the next, and the other for my future without him in it.
Let me take a moment and say that we're talking today with Lynn Freed, the author of a novel called The Mirror, a portion of which she just read. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Lynn, the half-breed child, comes to Durban later in Agnes's life.
Right.
And finds her.
Right. The hunter goes off to fight in the Second World War, and clearly is killed in the Second World War, although this happens off stage. But he leaves a note with his woman or wife in the bush to say that if he doesn't return, to send this boy to find Agnes, which is what happens. And the boy does come, but he's wretchedly homesick, and the presumption by Agnes, which in fact seems to happen, is that when he's spent enough time being homesick, he'll go back to the bush.
Lynn, tell us about yourself, your experience in growing up in South Africa in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s.
Well, I think any country that one grows up in, however strange and odd, which South Africa certainly was in many aspects, seems at the time to be normal to one, even though one is told or one reads in the newspapers that this kind of normalcy is not acceptable either to oneself or to the world. I grew up in a family of liberal, at least liberal-claiming Jews. I went to a British girls' boarding school, although I wasn't a boarder. My parents were actors, and my mother had a theatre school. My father and many of the other actors had other jobs. My father ran his father's business, but he was an actor. He had been in the Cambridge Players in England, and my mother had been at RADA. And then they went back to South Africa after they were finished their students were in theatre all their lives.
Your parents were natives of South Africa?
They were both born there, my father of English parents and my mother of Russian parents. So, yes, they were both first-generation South Africans. And so I grew up in a rather peculiar household, not typical. We lived in a huge old house, 20-room mansion, that my father had grown up in. And they were always off to the theatre at night, and there was always much drama on the home front as well as on the stage. I was the youngest of three girls, quite much the youngest, and so happily for me, rather left to be free. And so I ran around a lot. It was a rather free childhood. I was unsupervised, except for school and the usual things. And I had, most childhoods are fraught with various things, but I think within that, given that, I had rather a fine childhood.
What was the drama that you refer to in your home?
Oh, there was always fighting and shouting and all sorts of noise. My parents were both quite dramatic, and if things were not lively enough, then they would make them lively by fighting with each other, and that we were always fighting with each other. And then there were five servants who were in and out, and there was always drama around that. Actually, my second published novel is a very much fictionalized version of that. It's called Home Ground, and it's about just such a family, a lot fictionalized.
At some point, you left South Africa and traveled extensively around the world.
Well, what I did was I left South Africa when I finished my basic degree and came to America as a graduate student, got married very early, had a child quite young, and then was teaching for a while and just desperate for a life of my own. And so what I did was stop teaching. I was teaching in the university, and I became a travel agent. And under that guise, and I also started writing novels. I wrote three novels while I was doing this. For 10 years, I used to take off and go and travel on my own all over the places that I wanted to go to, Egypt, South America a lot, parts of Africa, at least parts of Southern Africa, and Europe, which I had to that point not seen. And I liked to travel on my own, and I did so quite extensively. So that's how it happened. But it wasn't as a girl. It was really as a young mother that I was doing this, rather frowned on by a lot of people. But anyway, I'm not sorry.
Taking your children with you?
No, I only have one child. I sometimes would take her with me, and I often would send her from when she was about 6 years old. She was flying on her own all over the world. I'd send her to South Africa and then pick her up there, or they'd send her to meet me in London. She was quite independent, and although she didn't love it when I would take off, she adjusted to it. Children are remarkable.
As you said earlier, when you grow up in a place you don't know it's different from anywhere else.
Right, I found out. I would go back to South Africa a lot. It's a country that I love and have always loved, I'm talking about the physical aspect and the people I know there, and it's home to me. And for some reason, it's the country of my imagination.
tell us, if you would, about the changes and your interpretation of the changes that are going on in South Africa now.
Well, I'm really not qualified to comment on the changes in any but a rather interested observing way, because I've been out of that country living for 30 years, although, of course, as I said, it's my country. I think changes are remarkable, wonderful, the most wonderful thing that one could hope for. I grew up all my childhood expecting a revolution any minute. I mean, it was the horror of childhood, living under the cloud of the Holocaust and then growing up with the terror of a revolution.
You speak of the revolution of the blacks against the whites.
I and my family and everybody that I knew fully expected that one day this would happen, and it should happen. We just didn't particularly want to be wrapped up in the middle of it.
Well, being a member of a liberal family, what sort of discussion or what sort of ideas were there in your home that would affect the potential revolution that you speak of?
Well, I don't want to overplay the liberal hand. I mean, these were people who were liberal by association. They disapproved of the government, and they were vociferous about this, as were most of the people that I associated with and that they associated with. But the political discussions around the dinner table or in the home were so rare and of such a primitive order that I don't really think they would be worthy of talking about. My parents were deeply uninterested in politics. It was as if, really, it was just a nuisance out there and a bad thing and tut-tut-tut, but on went life. So really, they were not sophisticated in their opinions, by no means. And they were just slightly less blind than most South African whites at the time to what was going on, but only slightly.
When they escaped the pogroms of the Jews around the turn of the century, which I presume is what caused them to flee, did they bring with them a substantive Jewish heritage?
To answer the first part of the question, my parents themselves did not flee at all. And in fact,
my mother's parents
left under those kinds of circumstances. My father's parents were already in England and had been for a couple of generations. So they were not, whatever they fled when they fled, it was not the late 19th century pogroms. But my parents both grew up in extremely observant Jewish families, and so did I. My parents were, oddly enough, I mean, so much about my upbringing was anomalous, but they were extremely identified Jews. We were sent to Hebrew school 3 times a week. We were sent to synagogue once a week. All the holidays were observed, and most of the South Africans when I was growing up were by affiliation Orthodox Jews, and probably still are. I'm not sure of that, though. So we were too, but then that was one side with a vast family who would meet every Friday night. I was never allowed out on a Friday night. They didn't keep kosher, which was considered an amazing thing by their families, but then after a while, their generation of families followed suit. So there was that, the Jewish side of things, and then there was their theatre work, which took them into a totally other world of people, and so there were these sort of two areas of their lives which didn't have much to do with each other, in fact had nothing to do with each other, but were equally important to them. And so we grew up with those two different aspects. They were very much Anglo-Jews within the South African context, both of them having spent time in England, especially my father, who had gone to boarding school in England, to public school.
And whose parents were English?
Parents were English, yes.
Certainly. Mm. Well, Lynn, what are you working on now in your home in Northern California?
Well, I'm at the moment at the beginning of a book, and I find it extremely difficult to talk about what I'm writing before I really know it. So it's a book of nonfiction, actually, a memoir. But more than that, I can't really say because I'm still finding out. But I do a lot of short stories. Not a lot. I write short stories. I write whatever comes to hand, to the imagination's hand, should I say.
Well, Lynn Fried, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests. And that is, could you please tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
me think of that. What have I read lately? I go blank when I'm asked that. I'm so sorry. What am I reading? I'm reading Jonathan Yardley's Misfit, which is it's a wonderful biography of Frederick Exley. And I'm reading George Orwell's essays. I tend to read several books at once. And I'm reading a wonderful book by Graham Boynton called Last Days in Cloud Cuckoo Land about the end of white rule in Rhodesia. So that's three.
Well, Lynn Fried, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Lynn Fried is the author of The Mirror, the story of Agnes LaGrange. The books that she recommends are Misfit by Jonathan Yardley, Essays by George Orwell, and The Last Days in Cloud Cuckoo Land Dispatches by Graham Boynton. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.